Toward Triumph. By 10 o'clock in the morning on Monday, October 8, 1893, the day Frank Millet had designated as Chicago Day, ticket takers at the fair's 64th Street gate made an informal count of the morning's sales thus far, and found that this one gate had recorded 60,000 paid admissions. The men knew from experience that on any ordinary day, sales at this gate accounted for about one-fifth the total for any given time, and so came up with an estimate that some 300,000 paid visitors already had entered Jackson Park, more than any other full day's total, and close to the world's record of 397,000 held by the Paris Exposition. Yet the morning had barely begun. The ticket takers sensed that something odd was happening. The pace of admissions seemed to be multiplying by the hour. In some ticket booths, the volume grew so great so quickly that silver coin began piling on the floors and burying the ticket takers' shoes. Millet and other fair officials had expected high attendance. Chicago was proud of its fair, and everyone knew that only 3 weeks remained before it would close forever. To assure maximum attendance, Mayor Harrison had signed an official proclamation that urged every business to suspend operation for the day. The courts closed, as did the Board of Trade. The weather helped, too. Monday was an apple-crisp day with temperatures that never exceeded 62 degrees under vivid cerulean skies. Every hotel had filled to capacity, even beyond capacity, with some managers finding themselves compelled to install cots in lobbies and halls. The Wellington Catering Company, which operated 8 restaurants and 40 lunch counters in Jackson Park, had braced for the day by shipping in 2 train car loads of potatoes, 4,000 half-barrels of beer, 15,000 gallons of ice cream, and 40,000 pounds of meat. Its cooks built 200,000 ham sandwiches and brewed 400,000 cups of coffee. No one, however, expected the sheer crush of visitors that actually did arrive. By noon, the chief of admissions, Horace Tucker, wired a message to fair headquarters, "The Paris record is broken to smithereens, and the people are still coming." A single ticket seller, L. E. Decker, a nephew of Buffalo Bill, who had sold tickets for Bill's Wild West for 8 years, sold 17,843 tickets during his shift, the most by any one man, and won Horace Tucker's prize of a box of cigars. Lost children filled every chair at the headquarters of the Columbian Guard. 19 spent the night and were claimed by their parents the next day. 5 people were killed in or near the fair, including a worker obliterated while helping prepare the night's fireworks, and a visitor who stepped from one grip car right into the path of another. A woman lost her foot when a surging crowd knocked her from a train platform. George Ferris, riding his wheel that day, looked down and gasped, "There must be 1 million people down there." The fireworks began at 8 o'clock sharp. Millet had planned an elaborate series of explosive set pieces, fireworks affixed to large metal frames shaped to depict various portraits and tableaus. The first featured the Great Fire of 1871, including an image of Mrs. O'Leary's fabled cow kicking over a lantern. The night boomed and hissed. For the finale, the fair's pyrotechnicians launched 5,000 rockets all at once into the black sky over the lake. The true climax occurred after the grounds closed, however. In the silence, with the air still scented with exploded powder, collectors accompanied by armed guards went to each ticket booth and collected the accumulated silver, 3 tons of it. They counted the money under heavy guard. By 1:45 a.m., they had an exact total. Ferris had nearly gotten it right. In that single day, 713,646 people had paid to enter Jackson Park. Only 31,059, 4%, were children. Another 37,380 visitors entered using passes and brought the total admission for the day to 751,026, more people than had attended any single day of any peaceable event in history. The Tribune argued that the only greater gathering was the massing of Xerxes' army of over 5 million souls in the 5th century BC. The Paris record of 397,000 had indeed been shattered. When the news reached Burnham's shanty, there were cheers and champagne and stories through the night. But the best news came the next day, when officials of the World's Columbian Exposition Company, whose boasts had been ridiculed far and wide, presented a check for $1.5 million to the Illinois Trust and Savings Company, and thereby extinguished the last of the exposition's debts. The Windy City had prevailed. Now Burnham and Millett made final arrangements for Burnham's own great day, the grand closing ceremony of October 30th that would recognize once and for all that Burnham really had done it, and that his work was now complete, that for once there was nothing left to do. At this point, Burnham believed, nothing could tarnish the fair's triumph or his own place in architectural history. Departures. Frank Millett expected the closing ceremony to attract even more people than the fair's Chicago day. While Millett did his planning, many of the other men who had helped Burnham construct the fair began the return to ordinary life. Charles McKim disengaged reluctantly. For him, the fair had been a brilliant light that for a time dispelled the shadows that had accumulated around his life. He left Jackson Park abruptly on the morning of October 23rd, and later that day wrote to Burnham, "You know my dislike for saying goodbye, and were prepared to find that I had skipped this morning. To say that I was sorry to leave you all is to put it only one half as strongly as I feel. You gave me a beautiful time, and the last days of the fair will always remain in my mind, as were the first, especially identified with yourself. It will be pleasant for the rest of our natural lives to be able to look back to it and talk it over and over and over again, and it goes without saying that you can depend upon me in every way as often hereafter as you may have need of me." The next day, McKim wrote to a friend in Paris of the deepening consensus among himself, Burnham, and most of Chicago, that the fair was too wonderful a thing to be allowed simply to fall into disrepair after its official closure on October 30th, just 6 days hence. Indeed, it is the ambition of all concerned to have it swept away in the same magical manner in which it appeared, and with the utmost dispatch. For economy, as well as for obvious reasons, it has been proposed that the most glorious way would be to blow up the buildings with dynamite. Another scheme is to destroy them with fire. This last would be the easiest and grandest spectacle, except for the danger of flying embers in the event of a change of wind from the lake. Neither McKim nor Burnham truly believed the fair should be set aflame. The buildings, in fact, had been designed to maximize the salvage value of their components. Rather, this talk of conflagration was a way of easing the despair of watching the dream come to an end. No one could bear the idea of the white city lying empty and desolate. A cosmopolitan writer said, "Better to have it vanish suddenly in a blaze of glory than fall into gradual disrepair and dilapidation." There is no more melancholy spectacle than a festal hall, the morning after the banquet, when the guests have departed and the lights are extinguished. Later, these musings about fire would come to seem like prophecy. Olmsted, too, severed his connection. Toward the end of summer, his busy schedule and the stifling heat caused his health to fail once again and reactivated his insomnia. He had many projects underway, chief among them Biltmore, but he felt himself nearing the end of his career. He was 71 years old. On September 6, 1893, he wrote to a friend, Fred Kingsbury, "I can't come to you, and often dream of a ride through our old haunts and meeting you and others, but have pretty well surrendered to fate. I must flounder along my way to the end. Olmsted did, however, allow himself a rare expression of satisfaction. I enjoy my children, he told Kingsbury. They are one of the centers of my life, the other being the improvement of scenery and making the enjoyment of it available. Spite of my infirmities, which do drag me cruelly, I am not to be thought of as an unhappy old man. Lewis Sullivan, engorged with praise and awards for his transportation building, especially its golden door, again took up his work with Dankmar Adler, but under changed circumstances. The deepening depression and missteps by the two partners had left the firm with few projects. For all of 1893, they would complete only two buildings. Sullivan, never easy on his peers, became furious with one of the firm's junior architects when he discovered the man had been using his free time to design houses for clients of his own. Sullivan fired him. The junior man was Frank Lloyd Wright. 10,000 construction workers also left the fair's employ and returned to a world without jobs, already crowded with unemployed men. Once the fair closed, many thousands more would join them on Chicago's streets. The threat of violence was as palpable as the deepening cold of autumn. Mayor Harrison was sympathetic and did what he could. He hired thousands of men to clean streets and ordered police stations opened at night for men seeking a place to sleep. Chicago's Commercial and Financial Chronicle reported, "Never before has there been such a sudden and striking cessation of industrial activity." Pig iron production fell by half, and new rail construction shrank almost to nothing. Demand for rail cars to carry visitors to the exposition had spared the Pullman works, but by the end of the fair, George Pullman, too, began cutting wages and workers. He did not, however, reduce the rents in his company town. The white city had drawn men and protected them. The black city now welcomed them back on the eve of winter, with filth, starvation, and violence. Holmes, too, sensed it was time to leave Chicago. The pressure from creditors and families was growing too great. First, he set fire to the top floor of his castle. The blaze did minimal damage, but he filed a claim for $6,000 on a policy acquired by his fictional alter ego, Hiram S. Campbell. An investigator for one of the insurance companies, F.G. Cowie, became suspicious and decided to begin a detailed investigation. Though he found no concrete evidence of arson, Cowie believed Holmes or an accomplice had started the fire. He advised the insurers to pay the claim, but only to Hiram S. Campbell, and only if Campbell presented himself in person. Holmes could not claim the money himself, for by now Cowie knew him. Ordinarily, he simply would have recruited someone else to masquerade as Campbell and claim the money, but of late he had become increasingly wary. The guardians of Minnie Williams had dispatched an attorney, William Capp, to look for Minnie and to protect the assets of her estate. Anna's guardian, the Reverend Dr. Black, had hired a private detective who had come to Holmes's building. And letters continued to arrive from the Sigrins and Smythes and other parents. No one yet had accused Holmes of foul play, but the intensity of this new wave of inquiry was greater, more obliquely accusatory than anything he previously had experienced. Hiram S. Campbell never claimed the money. But Holmes found that Cowie's investigation had a secondary, more damaging effect. In the course of digging up information about Holmes, he had succeeded in stirring up and uniting Holmes's creditors, the furniture dealers and iron suppliers and bicycle manufacturers and contractors whom Holmes had cheated over the previous 5 years. The creditors now hired an attorney named George B. Chamberlain, counsel for Chicago's Lafayette Collection Agency, who had been pestering Holmes ever since he failed to pay the furnace company for improving his kiln. Later, Chamberlain would claim to be the first man in Chicago to suspect Holmes of being a criminal. In the fall of 1893, Chamberlain contacted Holmes and requested he come to a meeting at his office. Holmes believed he and Chamberlain would be meeting alone, one-on-one, but when Holmes arrived at the office, he found it occupied by 24 creditors and their attorneys, and 1 police detective. This surprised Holmes, but did not faze him. He shook hands and met the angry gazes of his creditors head-on. Tempers immediately cooled a few degrees. He had that effect. Chamberlain had planned the meeting as a trap to try to shatter Holmes's imperturbable facade, and was impressed with Holmes's ability to maintain his insouciance despite the rancor in the room. Chamberlain told Holmes that altogether he owed the creditors at least $50,000. Holmes adopted his most sober expression. He understood their concerns. He explained his lapses. His ambition had gotten ahead of his ability to pay his debts. Things would have been fine, all the debts resolved, if not for the panic of 1893, which had ruined him and destroyed his hopes, just as it had for countless others in Chicago and the nation at large. Incredibly, Chamberlain saw, some of the creditors nodded in sympathy. Tears filled Holmes's eyes. He offered his deepest, most heartfelt apologies. And he suggested a solution. He proposed to settle his debts by giving the group a mortgage secured by his various properties. This nearly made Chamberlain laugh, yet one of the attorneys present in the room actually advised the group to accept Holmes's offer. Chamberlain was startled to see that Holmes's false warmth seemed to be mollifying the creditors. A few moments earlier, the group had wanted the detective to arrest Holmes the moment he entered the room. Now they wanted to talk about what to do next. Chamberlain told Holmes to wait in an adjacent room. Holmes did so. He waited peacefully. As the meeting progressed and grew heated, the attorney who previously had wanted to accept Holmes's mortgage stepped out of Chamberlain's office and entered the room where Holmes waited, ostensibly for a drink of water. He and Holmes talked. Exactly what happened next is unclear. Chamberlain claimed later that this attorney had been so angry at having his recommendation rebuffed that he tipped Holmes to the fact the creditors were again leaning toward arrest. It is possible, too, that Holmes simply offered the attorney cash for the information, or deployed his false warmth and cheery regret to seduce the attorney into revealing the group's mounting consensus. The attorney returned to the meeting. Holmes fled. Soon afterward, Holmes set out for Fort Worth, Texas, to take better advantage of Minnie Williams's land. He had plans for the property. He would sell some of it, and on the rest build a 3-story structure exactly like the one in Englewood. Meanwhile, he would use the land to secure loans and float notes. He expected to lead a very prosperous and satisfying life, at least until the time came to move on to the next city. He brought along his assistant, Benjamin Pitizel, and his new fiancée, the small and pretty Miss Georgiana Yoke. Just before leaving Chicago, Holmes acquired a life insurance policy from Fidelity Mutual Life of Philadelphia to insure Pitizel's life for $10,000. Nightfall. Throughout October, attendance at the fair rose sharply as more and more people realized the time left to see the White City was running short. On October 22nd, paid attendance totaled 138,011. Just 2 days later, it reached 244,127. 20,000 people a day now rode the Ferris wheel, 80% more than at the start of the month. Everyone hoped attendance would continue rising and that the number of people drawn to the closing ceremony of October 30th would break the record set on Chicago Day. To attract visitors for the close, Frank Millet planned a day-long celebration with music, speeches, fireworks, and a landing by Columbus himself from the exposition's full-sized replicas of the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria, built in Spain for the fair. Millet hired actors to play Columbus and his captains. The crew would consist of the men who had sailed the ships to Chicago. Millet arranged to borrow tropical plants and trees from the horticultural building and have them moved to the lakeshore. He planned also to coat the beach with fallen oak and maple leaves to signify the fact that Columbus landed in autumn, even though live palms and dead deciduous leaves were not precisely compatible. Upon landing, Columbus was to thrust his sword into the ground and claim the New World for Spain, while his men assumed positions that mimicked those depicted on a 2-cent postage stamp commemorating Columbus's discovery. Meanwhile, according to the Tribune, Indians recruited from Buffalo Bill's show and from various fair exhibits would peer cautiously at the landing party while shouting incoherently and running to and fro. With this enactment, Millet hoped to carry visitors back 400 years, despite the steam tugboats that would nudge the Spanish ships toward shore. First, however, came Mayor Harrison's big day, American Cities Day, on Saturday, October 28th. 5,000 mayors and city councilmen had accepted Harrison's invitation to the fair, among them the mayors of San Francisco, New Orleans, and Philadelphia. New York's mayor sent his regrets. There was only so much crow that even a city the size of New York could be expected to digest. That morning, Harrison delighted reporters by announcing that, yes, the rumors about him and the very young Miss Annie Howard were true. And not only that, the two planned to marry on November 16th. The glory time came in the afternoon when he rose to speak to the assembled mayors. Friends said he had never looked so handsome, so full of life. He praised the remarkable transformation of Jackson Park. "Look at it now," he said. "These buildings, this hall, this dream of poets of centuries is the wild aspiration of crazy architects alone." He told his audience, "I myself have taken a new lease of life," an allusion perhaps to Miss Howard, "and I believe I shall see the day when Chicago will be the biggest city in America and the third city on the face of the globe." He was 68 years old, but announced, "I intend to live for more than half a century, and at the end of that half century, London will be trembling lest Chicago shall surpass it." With a glance at the mayor of Omaha, he graciously offered to accept Omaha as a suburb. He changed course. "It sickens me when I look at this great exposition to think that it will be allowed to crumble to dust," he said. He hoped the demolition would be quick and quoted a recent remark by Burnham, "Let it go. It has to go, so let it go. Let us put the torch to it and burn it down." I believe with him. If we cannot preserve it for another year, I would be in favor of putting a torch to it and burning it down and let it go up into the bright sky to eternal heaven. Prendergast could stand it no longer. His visit to the Corporation Counsel's office, by rights, his office, had been humiliating. They had humored him, smirked. Yet Harrison had promised him the job. What did he have to do to get the mayor's attention? All his postcards had achieved nothing. No one wrote to him. No one took him seriously. At 2 o'clock on American Cities Day, Prendergast left his mother's house and walked to a shoe dealer on Milwaukee Avenue. He paid the dealer $4 for a used 6-chamber revolver. He knew that revolvers of this particular model had a penchant for accidental discharge when bumped or dropped, so he loaded it with only 5 cartridges and kept the empty chamber under the hammer. Later, much would be made of this precaution. At 3 o'clock, about the time Harrison was giving his speech, Prendergast walked into the Unity Building in central Chicago, where Governor John P. Altgeld had an office. Prendergast looked pale and strangely excited. An official of the building found his demeanor troubling and told him he could not enter. Prendergast returned to the street. It was nearly dark when Harrison left Jackson Park and drove north through the cold, smoky evening toward his mansion on Ashland Avenue. Temperatures had fallen sharply over the week, down to the 30s at night, and the sky seemed perpetually overcast. Harrison reached his home by 7 o'clock. He tinkered with a first-floor window, then sat down to supper with two of his children, Sophie and Preston. He had other children, but they were grown and gone. The supper, of course, included watermelon. In the midst of supper, at approximately 7:30, someone rang the bell at the front door. Mary Hansen, the parlor maid, answered and found a gaunt young man with a smooth-shaven face and close-cut black hair. He looked ill. He asked to see the mayor. By itself, there was nothing peculiar about the request. Evening visits by strangers were a regular occurrence at the Ashland House, for Harrison prided himself on being available to any citizen of Chicago, regardless of social stature. Tonight's visitor seemed seedier than most, however, and behaved oddly. Nonetheless, Mary Hansen told him to come back in half an hour. The day had been an exciting one for the mayor, but also exhausting. He fell asleep at the table. Shortly before 8 o'clock, his son left the dining room to go up to his room and dress for an engagement in the city later that night. Sophie also went upstairs to write a letter. The house was cozy and well lit. Mary Hansen and the other servants gathered in the kitchen for their own supper. At precisely 8 o'clock, the front bell again rang, and again Hansen answered it. The same young man stood at the threshold. Hansen asked him to wait in the hall and went to get the mayor. "It must have been about 8 o'clock when I heard a noise," Harrison's son Preston said. "I was startled. It sounded like a picture falling." Sophie heard it too and heard her father cry out. "I thought nothing of it," she said, "because I thought it was some screens falling on the floor near the back hall. Father's voice I took to be a yawn. He had a way of yawning very loud." Preston left his room and saw smoke drifting up from the entry hall. As he came down the steps, he heard two more reports. "The last shot was clear and penetrating," he said. "I knew it to be a revolver shot. It sounded like a manhole explosion." He ran to the hall and found Harrison lying on his back, surrounded by servants, the air silvered with gun smoke. There was very little blood. Preston shouted, "Father is not hurt, is he?" The mayor himself answered. "Yes," he said. "I am shot. I will die." Three more shots rang from the street. The coachman had fired his own revolver once in the air to alert police, once at Prendergast, and Prendergast had returned the shot. The commotion brought a neighbor, William J. Chalmers, who folded his coat under Harrison's head. Harrison told him he had been shot over the heart, but Chalmers did not believe it. There was too little blood. They argued. Chalmers told Harrison he had not been shot over the heart. Harrison snapped, "I tell you I am. This is death." A few moments later, his heart stopped. "He died angry," Chalmers said, "because I didn't believe him. Even in death, he is emphatic and imperious." Prendergast walked to the nearby Des Plaines Street police station and calmly told Desk Sergeant O.Z. Barber, "Lock me up. I am the man who shot the mayor." The sergeant was incredulous until Prendergast gave him the revolver, which smelled strongly of blown powder. Barber found that its cylinder contained 4 spent cartridges and a single live one. The 6th chamber was empty. Barber asked Prendergast why he had shot the mayor. "Because he betrayed my confidence. I supported him through his campaign, and he promised to appoint me corporation counsel. He didn't live up to his word." The exposition company canceled the closing ceremony. There would be no Jubilee March, no landing by Columbus, no address by Harlow Higginbotham, George Davis, or Bertha Palmer, no presentation of awards, no praise for Burnham and Olmsted, no Hail Columbia, no mass rendition of Auld Lang Syne. The closing became instead a memorial assembly in the fair's festival hall. As the audience entered, an organist played Chopin's funeral march on the hall's giant pipe organ. The hall was so cold the presiding officer announced that men could keep their hats on. Reverend Dr. J. H. Barrows read a blessing and benediction, and then, at the request of exposition officials, read a speech that Higginbotham had prepared for the originally planned ceremony. The remarks still seemed appropriate, especially one passage. "We are turning our backs upon the fairest dream of civilization and are about to consign it to the dust," Barrows read. "It is like the death of a dear friend." The audience exited slowly into the cold, gray afternoon. At exactly 4:45, sunset, the warship Michigan fired one of its cannon and continued to fire 20 times more as 1,000 men quietly took up positions at each of the exposition's flags. With the last boom of the Michigan's gun, the great flag at the administration building fell to the ground. Simultaneously, the 1,000 other flags also fell, as massed trumpeters and bassoonists in the court of honor played the Star-Spangled Banner and America. 200,000 visitors, many in tears, joined in. The fair was over. The 600 carriages in Carter Harrison's cortege stretched for miles. The procession moved slowly and quietly through a black sea of men and women dressed for mourning. A catafalque carrying Harrison's black casket led the cortege and was followed immediately by Harrison's beloved Kentucky mare, stirrups crossed on its empty saddle. Everywhere the white flags that had symbolized the white city hung at half-mast. Thousands of men and women wore buttons that said, "Our Carter," and watched in silence as carriage by carriage the city's greatest men drove past. Armour, Pullman, Schwab, Field, McCormick, Sears, Ward, and Burnham. It was a difficult ride for him. He had passed this way before, to bury John Root. The fair had begun with death. It had ended with death. So grand was the procession, it needed 2 hours to pass any one point. By the time it reached Graceland Cemetery north of the city, darkness had fallen and a soft mist hugged the ground. Long lines of policemen flanked the path to the cemetery's brownstone chapel. Off to the side stood 50 members of the United German Singing Societies. Harrison had heard them sing at a picnic and, joking, had asked them to sing at his funeral. Harrison's murder fell upon the city like a heavy curtain. There was the time before, there was the time after. Where once the city's newspapers would have run an endless series of stories about the after effects of the fair, now there was mostly silence. The fair remained open, informally, on October 31st, and many men and women came to the grounds for one last visit, as if paying their respects to a lost relative. A tearful woman told columnist Teresa Dean, "The goodbye is as sad as any I have known in all the years that I have lived." William Stead, the British editor whose brother Herbert had covered the fair's opening, arrived in Chicago from New York on the night of its official close, but made his first visit to the grounds on the 31st. He claimed that nothing he had seen in Paris, Rome, or London was as perfect as the Court of Honor. That night, the exposition illuminated the fair's grounds one last time. Beneath the stars, the lake lay dark and somber, Stead wrote. but on its shores gleamed and glowed in golden radiance the ivory city, beautiful as a poet's dream, silent as a city of the dead. The Black City. The exposition proved unable to hold the Black City at bay for very long. With its formal closure, thousands more workers joined the swelling army of the unemployed, and homeless men took up residence among the great, abandoned palaces of the fair. The poor had come lean and hungry out of the terrible winter that followed the World's Fair, wrote novelist Robert Herrick in The Web of Life. In that beautiful enterprise, the prodigal city had put forth her utmost strength, and having shown the world the supreme flower of her energy, had collapsed. The city's huge garment was too large for it. Miles of empty stores, hotels, flat buildings showed its shrunken state. Tens of thousands of human beings, lured to the festive city by abnormal wages, had been left stranded, without food or a right to shelter in its tenantless buildings. It was the contrast that was so wrenching. What a spectacle, wrote Ray Stannard Baker in his American Chronicle. What a human downfall after the magnificence and prodigality of the World's Fair, which had so recently closed its doors. Heights of splendor, pride, exaltation in one month, depths of wretchedness, suffering, hunger, cold in the next. In that first brutal winter, Burnham's photographer Charles Arnold took a very different series of photographs. One shows the machinery buildings soiled by smoke and litter. A dark liquid had been thrown against one wall. At the base of a column was a large box, apparently the home of an out-of-work squatter. It is desolation, wrote Teresa Dean, the columnist, about a visit she made to Jackson Park on January 2, 1894. You wish you had not come. If there were not so many around, you would reach out your arms, with the prayer on your lips for it all to come back to you. It seems cruel, cruel to give us such a vision, to let us dream and drift through heaven for 6 months, and then to take it out of our lives. 6 days after her visit, the first fires occurred and destroyed several structures, among them the famous peristyle. The following morning, Big Mary, chipped and soiled, stood over a landscape of twisted and blackened steel. The winter became a crucible for American labor. To workers, Eugene Debs and Samuel Gompers came increasingly to seem like saviors, Chicago's merchant princes like devils. George Pullman continued to cut jobs and wages without reducing rents, even though his company's treasury was flush with over $60 million in cash. Pullman's friends cautioned that he was being pig-headed and had underestimated the anger of his workers. He moved his family out of Chicago and hid his best china. On May 11, 1894, 2,000 Pullman workers went on strike with the support of Debs's American Railway Union. Other strikes broke out around the country, and Debs began planning a nationwide general strike to begin in July. President Cleveland ordered federal troops to Chicago and placed them under the command of General Nelson A. Miles, previously the Grand Marshal of the Exposition. Miles was uneasy about his new command. He sensed in the spreading unrest something unprecedented, more threatening and far-reaching than anything that had occurred before. He followed orders, however, and the former Grand Marshal of the fair wound up fighting the men who had built it. Strikers blocked trains and burned rail cars. On July 5, 1894, arsonists set fire to the 7 greatest palaces of the exposition: Post's immense manufacturers building, Hunt's dome, Sullivan's golden door, all of them. In the loop, men and women gathered on rooftops and in the highest offices of the rookery, the Masonic temple, the Temperance Tower, and every other high place to watch the distant conflagration. Flames rose 100 feet into the night sky and cast their gleam far out onto the lake. Belatedly, Burnham had gotten his wish. "There was no regret," observed the Chicago Tribune, "rather a feeling of pleasure that the elements and not the wrecker should wipe out the spectacle of the Columbian season." Later, in the next year, came the wonder. There are hundreds of people who went to Chicago to see the fair and were never heard from again, said the New York World. The list of the missing when the fair closed was a long one, and in the greater number, foul play suspected. Did these visitors to the fair, strangers to Chicago, find their way to Holmes's castle in answer to delusive advertisements sent out by him, never to return again? Did he erect his castle close to the fairgrounds so as to gather in these victims by the wholesale? The Chicago police had no answers, other than the obvious: that in Chicago, in the time of the fair, it was so very easy to disappear. Part 4. Cruelty Revealed, 1894 to 1895. Property of H. H. Holmes. Detective Frank Geyer was a big man with a pleasant, earnest face, a large walrus mustache, and a new gravity in his gaze and demeanor. He was one of Philadelphia's top detectives and had been a member of the force for 20 years, during which time he had investigated some 200 killings. He knew murder and its unchanging templates. Husbands killed wives, wives killed husbands, the poor killed one another, always for the usual motives of money, jealousy, passion, and love. Rarely did a murder involve the mysterious elements of dime novels or the stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. From the start, however, Geyer's current assignment had veered from the ordinary. One unusual aspect was that the suspect already was in custody, arrested November 17, 1894, for insurance fraud. The suspect was a physician whose given name was Mudgett, but who was known more commonly by the alias H. H. Holmes. He once had lived in Chicago, where he and an associate, Benjamin Pitetzel, had run a hotel during the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893. They had moved next to Fort Worth, Texas, then to St. Louis, and on to Philadelphia, committing frauds along the way. In Philadelphia, Holmes had swindled the Fidelity Mutual Life Association of nearly $10,000 by apparently faking the death of a policyholder, Ben Pitetzel. Holmes had bought the insurance in 1893 from Fidelity's Chicago office, just before the close of the exposition. As evidence of fraud accumulated, Fidelity had hired the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, the Eye That Never Sleeps, to search for Holmes. The agency's operatives picked up his trail in Burlington, Vermont, and followed him to Boston, where they arranged to have him arrested by police. Holmes confessed to the fraud and agreed to be extradited to Philadelphia for trial. At that point, the case appeared to be closed. But now it was June 1895. 7 months had passed since Holmes's arrest, and it was becoming increasingly apparent that he had not faked the death of Ben Pitetzel. He had killed him, and then arranged the scene to make the death seem accidental. Now, three of Pitetzel's 5 children, Alice, Nellie, and Howard, were missing, last seen in Holmes's company. Geyer's assignment was to find the children. He was invited to join the case by Philadelphia District Attorney George S. Graham, who over the years had come to rely on Geyer for the city's most sensitive investigations. Graham had thought twice this time, however, for he knew that just a few months earlier Geyer had lost his wife Martha and his 12-year-old daughter Esther in a house fire. Geyer interviewed Holmes in his cell, but learned nothing new. Holmes insisted that when he had last seen the children, they were alive and traveling with an accomplice named Minnie Williams, en route to the place where their father was hiding out. Geyer found Holmes to be smooth and glib, a social chameleon. Holmes is greatly given to lying with a sort of florid ornamentation, Geyer wrote, and all of his stories are decorated with flamboyant draperies, intended by him to strengthen the plausibility of his statements. In talking, he has the appearance of candor, becomes pathetic at times when pathos will serve him best, uttering his words with a quaver in his voice, often accompanied by a moistened eye, then turning quickly with a determined and forceful method of speech, as if indignation or resolution had sprung out of tender memories that had touched his heart. Holmes claimed to have secured a cadaver that resembled Pititzel and to have placed it on the second floor of a house rented especially for the fraud. By coincidence or out of some malignant expression of humor, the house was located right behind the city morgue, a few blocks north of City Hall. Holmes admitted arranging the cadaver to suggest that Pititzel had died in an accidental explosion. He poured a solvent on the cadaver's upper body and set it on fire, then positioned the body on the floor in direct sunlight. By the time the body was discovered, its features had been distorted well beyond recognition. Holmes volunteered to assist the coroner in making an identification. At the morgue, he had not only helped locate a distinctive wart on the dead man's neck, he pulled out his own lancet and removed the wart himself, then matter-of-factly handed it to the coroner. The coroner had wanted a member of the Pitetzel family also to be present at the identification. Pitetzel's wife, Carrie, was ill and could not come. Instead, she sent her second eldest daughter, Alice, 15 years old. The coroner's men draped the body so as to allow Alice to see only Pitetzel's teeth. She seemed confident that the corpse was her father. Fidelity paid the death benefit. Next, Holmes traveled to St. Louis, where the Pitetzel family now lived. Still in possession of Alice, he persuaded Carrie to let him pick up two more of her children, explaining that their father, in hiding, was desperate to see them. He took Nellie, 11, and Howard, 8, and embarked with all three children on a strange, sad journey. Geyer knew from Alice's letters that initially she found the trip to be something of an adventure. In a letter to her mother dated September 20, 1894, Alice wrote, "I wish you could see what I have seen." In the same letter she expressed her distaste for Holmes's treacly manner. "I don't like him to call me babe and child and dear and all such trash." The next day she wrote again, "Mama, have you ever seen or tasted a red banana? I have had three. They are so big that I can just reach around it and have my thumb and next finger just touch." Since leaving St. Louis, Alice had heard nothing from home and feared her mother's illness might have gotten much worse. "Have you gotten four letters from me besides this?" Alice wrote. "Are you sick in bed yet, or are you up? I wish that I could hear from you." One of the few things that Detective Geyer knew with certainty was that neither of these letters ever reached Carrie Pitetzel. Alice and Nellie had written to their mother repeatedly while in Holmes's custody, and had given the letters to Holmes with the expectation that he would mail them. He never did. Shortly after his arrest, police discovered a tin box marked "Property of H.H. Holmes," containing various documents and a dozen letters from the girls. He had stored them in the box as if they were seashells collected from a beach. Now Mrs. Pitetzel was nearly crushed with anxiety and grief, despite Holmes's latest assurances that Alice, Nellie, and Howard were in London, England, under the able care of Minnie Williams. A search by Scotland Yard had found no trace of any of them. Geyer had little hope that his own search would fare any better. With more than half a year having elapsed since anyone had heard from the children, Geyer wrote, "It did not look like a very encouraging task to undertake, and it was the general belief of all interested that the children would never be found. The district attorney believed, however, that another final effort to find the children should be made for the sake of the stricken mother, if for nothing else. I was not placed under any restrictions, but was told to go and exercise my own judgment in the matter and to follow wherever the clues led me. Geyer set out on his search on the evening of June 26, 1895, a hot night in a hot summer. Earlier in June, a zone of high pressure, the permanent high, had settled over the mid-Atlantic states and driven temperatures in Philadelphia well into the 90s. A humid stillness held the countryside. Even at night, the air inside Geyer's train was stagnant and moist. Leftover cigar smoke drifted from men's suits, and at each stop the roar of frogs and crickets filled the air. Geyer slept in jagged stretches. The next day, as the train sped west through the heat-steamed hollows of Pennsylvania and Ohio, Geyer reread his copies of the children's letters to look for anything he might have missed that could help direct his search. The letters not only provided irrefutable proof that the children had been with Holmes, but contained enough geographic references to allow Geyer to plot the broad contours of the route he and the children had followed. Their first stop appeared to have been Cincinnati. Geyer reached Cincinnati at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, June 27th. He checked into the Palace Hotel. The next morning he went to police headquarters to brief the city's police superintendent on his mission. The superintendent assigned a detective to assist him, Detective John Schnooks, an old friend of Geyer's. Geyer hoped to reconstruct the children's travels from Cincinnati onward. There was no easy way to achieve his goal. He had few tools other than his wits, his notebook, a handful of photographs, and the children's letters. He and Detective Schnooks made a list of all the hotels in Cincinnati located near railroad stations, then set out on foot to visit each one and check its registrations for some sign of the children and Holmes. That Holmes would use an alias seemed beyond doubt, so Geyer brought along his photographs, even a depiction of the children's distinctive flat-top trunk. 9 months had passed since the children had written their letters, however. Geyer had little hope that anyone would remember one man and three children. On that point, as it happens, he was wrong. The detectives trudged from one hotel to the next. The day got hotter and hotter. The detectives were courteous and never showed impatience, despite having to make the same introductions and tell the same story over and over again. On Central Avenue, they came to a small, inexpensive hotel, the Atlantic House. As they had done at all the other hotels, they asked the clerk if they could see his registration book. They turned first to Friday, September 28, 1894, the day that Holmes, while already in possession of Alice, had picked up Nellie and Howard from their St. Louis home. Geyer guessed Holmes and the children had reached Cincinnati later that same Friday. Geyer ran his finger down the page for September 28th and stopped at an entry for Alex E. Cook, a guest who, according to the register, was traveling with three children. The entry jogged Geyer's memory. Holmes had used the name before to rent a house in Burlington, Vermont. Also, Geyer by now had seen a lot of Holmes's handwriting. The writing in the ledger looked familiar. The Cook party stayed only one night, the register showed. But Geyer knew from the girls' letters that they had remained in Cincinnati at least two more days. It seemed odd that Holmes would go to the trouble of moving to a second hotel, but Geyer knew from experience that making assumptions about the behavior of criminals was always a dangerous thing. He and Schnooks thanked the clerk for his kind attention, then set out to canvass more hotels. The sun was high, the streets steamed. Cicadas scratched off messages from every tree. At 6th and Vine, the detectives came to a hotel called the Bristol and discovered that on Saturday, September 29, 1894, a party identified as A. E. Cook had checked in with three children. When the clerk saw Geyer's photographs, he confirmed that the guests were Holmes, Alice, Nellie, and Howard. They checked out the next morning, Sunday, September 30th. The date fit the likely chronology of events. Guyer knew from the children's letters that on that Sunday morning, they had left Cincinnati and by evening had arrived in Indianapolis. Guyer was not yet ready to leave Cincinnati, however. Now he played a hunch. The Pinkertons had found that Holmes sometimes rented houses in the cities through which he traveled, as he had done in Burlington. Guyer and Schnooks turned their attention to Cincinnati's real estate agents. Their search eventually took them to the realty office of J.C. Thomas on East 3rd Street. Something about Holmes must have caused people to take notice, because both Thomas and his clerk remembered him. Holmes had rented a house at 305 Poplar Street under the name A.C. Hayes and had made a substantial advance payment. The date of the agreement, Thomas said, was September 28, 1894, the Friday when Holmes and the children had arrived in Cincinnati. Holmes held the house only 2 days. Thomas could offer no further details but referred the detectives to a woman named Henrietta Hill, who lived next door to the house. Guyer and Schnooks immediately set out for Miss Hill's residence and found her to be an acute observer and a willing gossip. "There is really very little to tell," she said. Then told them a lot. She first had noticed the new tenant on Saturday, September 29th, when a furniture wagon stopped in front of the rental house. A man and a boy descended. What most caught Miss Hill's attention was the fact the furniture wagon was empty, save for an iron stove that seemed much too large for a private residence. Miss Hill found the stove sufficiently strange that she mentioned it to her neighbors. The next morning, Holmes came to her front door and told her he was not going to stay in the house after all. If she wanted the stove, he said, she could have it. Detective Guyer theorized that Holmes must have sensed an excess of neighborly scrutiny and changed his plans. But what were those plans? At the time, Guyer wrote, "I was not able to appreciate the intense significance of the renting of the Poplar Street house and the delivery of a stove of such immense size." He was certain, however, that he had taken firm hold of the end of the string that would lead to the children. Based on the girl's letters, Guyer's next stop was obvious. He thanked Detective Schnooks for his companionship and caught a train to Indianapolis. It was even hotter in Indianapolis. Leaves hung in the stillness like hands of the newly dead. Early Sunday morning, Guyer went to the police station and picked up a new local partner, Detective David Richards. One part of the trail was easy to find. In Nellie Pitetzel's letter from Indianapolis, she had written, "We are at the English H." Detective Richards knew the place, the Hotel English. In the hotel's register, Guyer found an entry on September 30th for 3 Canning children. Canning, he knew, was Carrie Pitetzel's maiden name. Nothing was simple, however. According to the register, the Canning children had checked out the next day, Monday, October 1st. Yet Guyer knew, again from their letters, that the children had remained in Indianapolis for at least another week. Holmes seemed to be repeating the pattern he had established in Cincinnati. Guyer began the same methodical canvass he had conducted in Cincinnati. He and Detective Richards checked hotel after hotel, but found no further reference to the children. They did, however, find something else. At a hotel called the Circle Park, they discovered an entry for a Mrs. Georgia Howard. Howard was one of Holmes's more common aliases, Guyer now knew. He believed this woman could be Holmes's latest wife, Georgiana Yoke. The register showed that Mrs. Howard had checked in on Sunday, September 30th, 1894, and stayed 4 nights. Guyer showed his photographs to the hotel's proprietor, a Mrs. Rodius, who recognized Holmes and Yoke, but not the children. Mrs. Rhodius and Yoke had become friends. In one conversation, Yoke told her that her husband was a very wealthy man and that he owned real estate and cattle ranches in Texas. Also had considerable real estate in Berlin, Germany, where they intended to go as soon as her husband could get his business affairs into shape to leave. The timing of all these hotel stays was perplexing. As best Geyer could tell, on that one Sunday, September 30th, Holmes somehow had managed to maneuver the three children and his own wife into different hotels in the same city, without revealing their existence to each other. But where had the children gone next? Geyer and Richards examined the registers of every hotel and boarding house in Indianapolis, but found no further trace of the children. The Indianapolis leg of Geyer's search seemed to have reached a dead end when Richards remembered that a hotel called the Circle House had been opened during the fall of 1894, but had since closed. He and Geyer checked with other hotels to find out who had run the Circle House and learned from its former clerk that the registration records were in the possession of a downtown attorney. The records had been poorly kept, but among the guests who had arrived on Monday, October 1st, Geyer found a familiar entry, three Canning children. The register showed the children were from Galva, Illinois, the town where Mrs. Pititzel had grown up. Geyer now felt a pressing need to talk to the hotel's past manager and found him running a saloon in West Indianapolis. His name was Herman Acalo. Geyer explained his mission and immediately showed Acalo his photographs of Holmes and the Pititzel children. Acalo was silent a moment. Yes, he said. He was sure of it. The man in the photograph had come to his hotel. It was the children, however, that he remembered most clearly. And now he told the detectives why. Until this point, all Geyer knew about the children's stay in Indianapolis was what he had read in the letters from the tin box. Between October 6th and 8th, Alice and Nellie had written at least three letters that Holmes had intercepted. The letters were brief and poorly written, but they offered small, bright glimpses into the daily lives of the children and the state of near captivity in which Holmes held them. "We are all well here," Nellie wrote on Saturday, October 6th. "It is a little warmer today. There is so many buggies go by that you can't hear yourself think. I first wrote you a letter with a crystal pen. It is all glass, so I have to be careful or else it will break. It was only 5 cents. Alice wrote a letter the same day. She had been away from her mother the longest, and for her the trip had become wearisome and sad. It was Saturday, raining hard. She had a cold and was reading Uncle Tom's Cabin so much that her eyes had begun to hurt. And I expect this Sunday will pass away slower than I don't know what. Why don't you write to me? I have not got a letter from you since I have been away, and it will be 3 weeks day after tomorrow. On Monday, Holmes allowed a letter from Mrs. Pititzel to reach the children, which prompted Alice to write an immediate reply, observing, "It seems as though you were awful homesick." In this letter, which Holmes never mailed, Alice reported that little Howard was being difficult. "One morning Mr. H. told me to tell him to stay in the next morning, that he wanted him, and he would come and get him and take him out." But Howard had not obeyed, and when Holmes came for him, the boy was nowhere to be found. Holmes had gotten angry. Despite her sorrow and boredom, Alice found a few cheery moments worth celebrating. "Yesterday we had mashed potatoes, grapes, chicken, glass of milk each, ice cream each, a big sauce dish full, awful good, too, lemon pie, cake. Don't you think that is pretty good?" The fact the children were so well fed might have comforted Mrs. Pititzel, had she ever received the letter. Not so, however, the story the former hotel manager now told Geyer. Each day, Acalo would send his eldest son up to the children's room to call them for their meals. Often the boy reported back that the children were crying. evidently heartbroken and homesick to see their mother or hear from her, Geyer wrote. A German chambermaid named Carolyn Klausmann had tended the children's room and observed the same wrenching scenes. She had moved to Chicago, Akilov said. Geyer wrote her name in his notebook. Holmes said that Howard was a very bad boy, Akilov recalled, and that he was trying to place him in some institution or bind him out to some farmer, as he wanted to get rid of the responsibility of looking after him. Geyer still nurtured a small hope that the children really were alive, as Holmes insisted. Despite his 20 years on the police force, Geyer found it difficult to believe that anyone could kill 3 children for absolutely no reason. Why had Holmes gone to the trouble and expense of moving the children from city to city, hotel to hotel, if only to kill them? Why had he bought each of them a crystal pen and taken them to the zoo in Cincinnati and made sure they received lemon pie and ice cream? With each new step in the search, however, the story became only more sinister. The insurance fraud a portal to something infinitely more grotesque. Geyer set out for Chicago but felt deep reluctance about leaving Indianapolis. Something seemed to tell me that Howard had never left there alive. In Chicago, he found, to his surprise, that the city's police department knew nothing about Holmes. He tracked down Carolyn Klausmann, who was now working at the Swiss Hotel on Clark Street. When he showed her his photographs of the children, tears welled in her eyes. Geyer caught a train to Detroit, the city where Alice had written the last of the letters in the tin box. Geyer was getting a feel for his quarry. There was nothing rational about Holmes, but his behavior seemed to follow a pattern. Geyer knew what to look for in Detroit, and with the assistance of another police detective, once again began a patient canvas of hotels and boarding houses. Though he told his story and showed his photographs 100 times, he never tired and was always patient and polite. These were his strengths. His weakness was his belief that evil had boundaries. Once again, he picked up the children's trail and the parallel registrations of Holmes and Yoke, but now he discovered something even stranger. That during this same period, Carrie Pititzel and her 2 other children, Desi and Baby Wharton, had also checked into a Detroit hotel, this one called Geiss's Hotel. Geyer realized, to his astonishment, that Holmes now was moving 3 different parties of travelers from place to place, shoving them across the landscape as if they were toys. And he discovered something else. In walking from lodging to lodging, he saw not only that Holmes had kept Carrie away from Alice, Nellie, and Howard. He had placed them in establishments only 3 blocks apart. Suddenly, the true implication of what Holmes had done became clear to him. He reread Alice's final letter. She had written it to her grandparents on Sunday, October 14th, the same day in which her mother, along with Desi and the baby, had checked into Geiss's hotel. This was the saddest letter of them all. Alice and Nellie both had colds, and the weather had turned wintry. "Tell Mama that I have to have a coat," Alice wrote. "I nearly freeze in that thin jacket." The children's lack of warm clothing forced them to stay in their room day after day. "All that Nell and I can do is to draw, and I get so tired sitting that I could get up and fly almost. I wish I could see you all. I am getting so homesick that I don't know what to do. I suppose Wharton walks by this time, don't he? I would like to have him here. He would pass away the time a good deal." Geyer was appalled. So when this poor child Alice was writing to her grandparents in Galva, Illinois, complaining of the cold, sending a message to her mother, asking for heavier and more comfortable clothing, wishing for little Wharton, the baby who would help them pass away the time, while this wearied, lonely, homesick child was writing this letter, Her mother and her sister and the much-wished-for Wharton were within 10 minutes' walk of her, and continued there for the next 5 days. It was a game for Holmes, Gaia realized. He possessed them all, and reveled in his possession. One additional phrase of Alice's letter kept running through Geyer's brain. Howard, she had written, is not with us now. Moyamensing Prison. Holmes sat in his cell at Moyamensing Prison, a large turreted and crenellated building at 10th and Reed Streets in South Philadelphia. He did not seem terribly troubled by his incarceration, although he complained of its injustice. The great humiliation of feeling that I am a prisoner is killing me far more than any other discomforts I have to endure, he wrote, though in fact he felt no humiliation whatsoever. If he felt anything, it was a smug satisfaction that so far no one had been able to produce any concrete evidence that he had killed Ben Pitatzel or the missing children. He occupied a cell that measured 9 by 14 feet, with a narrow, barred window high in its outer wall and a single electric lamp, which guards extinguished at 9 o'clock each night. The walls were whitewashed. The stone construction of the prison helped blunt the extreme heat that had settled on the city and much of the country, but nothing could keep out the humidity for which Philadelphia was notorious. It clung to Holmes and his fellow prisoners like a shawl of moist wool. Yet this, too, he seemed not to mind. Holmes became a model prisoner. Became, in fact, the model of a model prisoner. He made a game of using his charm to gain concessions from his keepers. He was allowed to wear his own clothes and to keep my watch and other small belongings. He discovered also that he could pay to have food, newspapers, and magazines brought in from outside. He read of his increasing national notoriety. He read also that Frank Geyer, a Philadelphia police detective who had interviewed him in June, was now in the Middle West searching for Pitatzel's children. The search delighted Holmes. It satisfied his profound need for attention and gave him a sense of power over the detective. He knew that Geyer's search would be in vain. Holmes's cell was furnished with a bed, a stool, and a writing table, upon which he composed his memoir. He had begun it, he said, the preceding winter. To be exact, on December 3, 1894. He began the memoir as if it were a fable. Come with me, if you will, to a tiny, quiet New England village, nestling among the picturesquely rugged hills of New Hampshire. Here in the year 1861, I, Herman W. Mudgett, the author of these pages, was born. That the first years of my life were different from those of any other ordinary country-bred boy, I have no reason to think. The dates and places were correct. His description of his boyhood as a typical country idol was most certainly a fabrication. It is one of the defining characteristics of psychopaths that as children they lied at will, exhibited unusual cruelty to animals and other children, and often engaged in acts of vandalism, with arson an especially favored act. Holmes inserted into his memoir a prison diary, which he claimed to have kept since the day he arrived at Moyamensing. It is more likely that he invented the diary expressly for the memoir, intending it as a vehicle for reinforcing his claims of innocence by fostering the impression that he was a man of warmth and piety. He claimed in the diary to have established a daily schedule aimed at personal betterment. He would wake at 6:30 each day and take his usual sponge bath, then clean his cell. He would breakfast at 7. I shall eat no more meat of any kind while I am so closely confined. He planned to exercise and read the morning newspapers until 10 o'clock. From 10 to 12 and 2 to 4, 6 days in the week, I shall confine myself to my old medical works and other college studies, including stenography, French, and German. The rest of the day he would devote to reading various periodicals and library books. At one point in his diary, he notes that he was reading Trilby, the 1894 bestseller by George Du Maurier, about a young singer, Trilby O'Farrell, and her possession by the mesmerist Svengali. Holmes wrote that he was much pleased with parts of it. Elsewhere in the diary, Holmes went for the heart. One entry for May 16, 1895, my birthday, am 34 years old. I wonder if, as in former years, mother will write me. In another entry, he described a visit from his latest wife, Georgiana Yoke. She has suffered, and though she tried heroically to keep me from seeing it, it was of no avail. And in a few minutes, to again bid her goodbye and know she was going out into the world with so heavy a load to bear, caused me more suffering than any death struggles can ever do. Each day until I know she is safe from harm and annoyance will be a living death to me. From his cell, Holmes also wrote a long letter to Carrie Pititzel, which he composed in a manner that shows he was aware the police were reading his mail. He insisted that Alice, Nellie, and Howard were with Miss W. in London, and that if the police would only check his story in detail, the mystery of the children would be solved. I was as careful of the children as if they were my own, and you know me well enough to judge me better than strangers here can do. Ben would not have done anything against me or I against him any quicker than brothers. We never quarreled. Again, he was worth too much to me for me to have killed him, if I had no other reason not to. As to the children, I never will believe, until you tell me so yourself, that you think they are dead, or that I did anything to put them out of the way. Knowing me as you do, can you imagine me killing little and innocent children, especially without any motive? He explained the lack of mail from the children. They have no doubt written letters which Miss W., for her own safety, has withheld. Holmes read the daily papers closely. Clearly the detective's search had borne little fruit. Holmes had no doubt that soon Geyer would be forced to end his search and return to Philadelphia. The prospect of this was pleasing in the extreme. The Tenant. On Sunday, July 7, 1895, Detective Geyer took his search to Toronto, where the city's police department assigned Detective Alf Cuddy to assist him. Together, Geyer and Cuddy scoured the hotels and boarding houses of Toronto, and after days of searching found that here, too, Holmes had been moving three parties of travelers simultaneously. Holmes and Yoke had stayed at the Walker House. G. Howe and wife, Columbus. Mrs. Pititzel at the Union House. Mrs. C. A. Adams and daughter, Columbus. The girls at the Albion. Alice and Nellie Canning, Detroit. No one remembered seeing Howard. Now Geyer and Cuddy began searching the records of real estate agencies and contacting the owners of rental homes, but Toronto was far larger than any other city Geyer had searched. The task seemed impossible. On Monday morning, July 15th, he awoke facing the prospect of yet another day of mind-numbing routine, but when he arrived at headquarters, he found Detective Cuddy in an unusually good mood. A tip had come in that Cuddy found promising. A resident named Thomas Rives had read Holmes's description in a newspaper article and thought it sounded like a man who, in October 1894, had rented the house next door to his at 16 St. Vincent Street. Geyer was leery. The intensive press coverage of his mission and his arrival in Toronto had generated thousands of tips, all useless. Cuddy agreed that the latest tip was probably another wild goose chase, but at least it offered a change of pace. By now, Geyer was a national fascination, America's Sherlock Holmes. Reports of his travels appeared in newspapers throughout the nation. In this day, the possibility that a man had killed three young children was still considered a horror well beyond the norm. There was something about Detective Geyer's lone search through the sweltering heat of that summer that captured everyone's imagination. He had become the living representation of how men liked to think of themselves. One man doing an awful duty and doing it well against the odds. Millions of people woke each morning hoping to read in their newspapers that this staunch detective at last had found the missing children. Geyer paid little attention to his new celebrity. Nearly a month had passed since the start of his search, but what had he accomplished? Each new phase seemed only to raise new questions. Why did Holmes take the children? Why had he engineered that contorted journey from city to city? What power did Holmes possess that gave him such control? There was something about Holmes that Geyer just did not understand. Every crime had a motive, but the force that propelled Holmes seemed to exist outside the world of Geyer's experience. He kept coming back to the same conclusion. Holmes was enjoying himself. He had arranged the insurance fraud for the money, but the rest of it was for fun. Holmes was testing his power to bend the lives of people. What irked Geyer most was that the central question was still unanswered. Where were the children now? The detectives found Thomas Rives to be a charming Scotsman of considerable age, who welcomed them with enthusiasm. Rives explained why the renter next door had caught his attention. For one thing, he arrived with little furniture, a mattress, an old bed, and an unusually large trunk. One afternoon, the tenant came to Rives' house to borrow a shovel, explaining that he wanted to dig a hole in the cellar for the storage of potatoes. He returned the shovel the next morning, and the following day removed the trunk from the house. Rives never saw him again. Detective Geyer, now galvanized, told Rives to meet him in front of the neighboring house in exactly 1 hour. Then he and Cuddy sped to the home of the realtor who had arranged the rental. With little preamble, Geyer showed her a photograph of Holmes. She recognized him instantly. He had been very handsome, with amazing blue eyes. "This seemed too good to be true," Geyer wrote. He and Cuddy offered quick thanks and rushed back to St. Vincent Street. Rives was waiting outside. Now Geyer asked to borrow a shovel, and Rives returned with the same one he had loaned the tenant. The house was charming, with a steeply pitched central gable and scalloped trim like the gingerbread house in a fairy tale. Except this house did not sit alone in a deep wood, but in the heart of Toronto, on a fine street closely lined with elegant homes and yards fenced with fleur-de-lis pickets. Clematis, in full bloom, climbed one post of the veranda. The current tenant, a Mrs. J. Armbrust, answered the door. Rives introduced the detectives. Mrs. Armbrust led them inside. They entered a central hall that divided the house into halves of 3 rooms each. A stairwell led to the second floor. Geyer asked to see the cellar. Mrs. Armbrust led the detectives into the kitchen, where she lifted a sheet of oilcloth from the floor. A square trap door lay underneath. As the detectives opened it, the scent of moist earth drifted upward into the kitchen. The cellar was shallow but very dark. Mrs. Armbrust brought lamps. Geyer and Cuddy descended a steep set of steps, more ladder than stairway, into a small chamber about 10 feet long by 10 feet wide and only 4 feet high. The lamps shed a shifting orange light that exaggerated the detective's shadows. Hunched over, wary of the overhead beams, Geyer and Cuddy tested the ground with the spade. In the southwest corner, Geyer found a soft spot. The spade entered with disconcerting ease. "Only a slight hole had been made," Geyer said, when the gases burst forth and the stench was frightful. At 3 feet, they uncovered human bone. They summoned an undertaker named B.D. Humphrey to help recover the remains. Geyer and Cuddy gingerly climbed back down into the cellar. Humphrey leapt down. The stench now suffused the entire house. Mrs. Armbrust looked stricken. Then the coffins arrived. The undertaker's men put them in the kitchen. The children had been buried nude. Alice lay on her side, her head at the west end of the grave. Nellie lay face down, partially covering Alice. Her rich black hair, nicely plaited, lay along her back as neatly as if she had just combed it. The men spread a sheet on the cellar floor. They began with Nellie. "We lifted her as gently as possible," Geyer said, "but owing to the decomposed state of the body, the weight of her plaited hair hanging down her back pulled the scalp from her head." They discovered something else. Nellie's feet had been amputated. During the search of the residence that followed, police found no trace of them. At first, this seemed a mystery, until Geyer recalled that Nellie was club-footed. Holmes had disposed of her feet to remove this distinctive clue to her identity. Mrs. Pititzel learned of the discovery of her girls by reading a morning newspaper. She had been visiting friends back in Chicago, and thus Geyer had been unable to telegraph the news to her directly. She caught a train to Toronto. Geyer met her at the station and took her to his hotel, the Rawson House. She was exhausted and sad and seemed perpetually near fainting. Geyer roused her with smelling salts. Geyer and Cuddy came for her the next afternoon to bring her to the morgue. They carried brandy and smelling salts. Geyer wrote, "I told her that it would be absolutely impossible for her to see anything but Alice's teeth and hair, and only the hair belonging to Nellie." This had a paralyzing effect upon her, and she almost fainted. Her situation had captured the city's heart. The coroner's men did what they could to make the viewing as endurable as possible. They cleaned the flesh from Alice's skull and carefully polished her teeth, then covered her body with canvas. They laid paper over her face and cut a hole in the paper to expose only her teeth, just as the Philadelphia coroner had done for her father. They washed Nellie's hair and laid it carefully on the canvas that covered Alice's body. Cuddy and Geyer took positions on opposite sides of Mrs. Pititzel and led her into the dead house. She recognized Alice's teeth immediately. She turned to Geyer, "Where is Nellie?" and only then noticed Nellie's long black hair. The coroner, unable to find any marks of violence, theorized that Holmes had locked the girls in the big trunk, then filled it with gas from a lamp valve. Indeed, when police found the trunk, they discovered a hole drilled through one side, covered with a makeshift patch. "Nothing could be more surprising," Geyer wrote, "than the apparent ease with which Holmes murdered the two little girls in the very center of the city of Toronto, without arousing the least suspicion of a single person there. If not for Graham's decision to send him on his search, he believed, these murders would never have been discovered, and Mrs. Pititzel would have gone to her grave without knowing whether her children were alive or dead." For Geyer, finding the girls was one of the most satisfactory events of my life. But his satisfaction was tempered by the fact that Howard remained missing. Mrs. Pititzel refused to believe Howard was dead. She clung fondly to the hope that he would ultimately be found alive. Even Geyer found himself hoping that in this one case, Holmes had not lied and had done exactly what he had told the clerk in Indianapolis. Had he been placed in some institution, as Holmes had intimated his intention of doing, or was he hidden in some obscure place beyond reach or discovery? Was he alive or dead? I was puzzled, nonplussed, and groping in the dark. A lively corpse. In Philadelphia, on the morning of Tuesday, July 16, 1895, the day Geyer's Toronto discoveries were reported in the nation's newspapers, the district attorney's office telephoned an urgent message to the warden at Moyamensing Prison, instructing him to keep all the morning's newspapers away from Holmes. The order came from Assistant District Attorney Thomas W. Barlow. He wanted to surprise Holmes with the news, hoping it would rattle him so thoroughly that he would confess. Barlow's order came too late. The guard sent to intercept the morning papers found Holmes sitting at his table, reading the news as calmly as if reading about the weather. In his memoir, Holmes contended that the news did shock him. His newspaper came that morning at 8:30, as it always did, he wrote, and I had hardly opened it before I saw in large headlines the announcement of the finding of the children in Toronto. For the moment it seemed so impossible that I was inclined to think it one of the frequent newspaper excitements that had attended the earlier part of the case. But suddenly, he wrote, he realized what must have happened. Minnie Williams killed them, or had ordered them killed. Holmes knew she had an unsavory associate named Hatch. He guessed that Williams had suggested the killings, and Hatch had carried them out. It was all too horrible to comprehend. I gave up trying to read the article, and saw instead the two little faces as they had looked when I hurriedly left them, felt the innocent child's kiss so timidly given, and heard again their earnest words of farewell, and I realized that I had received another burden to carry to my grave. I think at this time I should have lost my senses utterly had I not been hurriedly called to prepare to be taken to the district attorney's office. The morning was hot. Holmes was driven north on Broad Street to City Hall through air as sticky as taffy. In the DA's office, he was questioned by Barlow. The Philadelphia Public Ledger reported that Holmes's genius for explanation had deserted him. For 2 hours, he sat under a shower of questions and refused to talk. He was not cowed by any means, but he would give absolutely no satisfaction. Holmes wrote, "I was in no condition to bear his accusations, nor disposed to answer many of his questions." He told Barlow that Miss Williams and Hatch apparently had killed Howard as well. Holmes was driven back to Moyamensing. He began earnestly trying to find a publisher for his memoir, hoping to get it quickly into print to help turn public opinion to his favor. If he could not exert his great powers of persuasion directly, he could at least attempt to do so indirectly in print. He struck a deal with a journalist named John King to arrange publication and market the book. He wrote to King, "My ideas are that you should get from the New York Herald and the Philadelphia Press all the cuts they have and turn those we want over to the printer to have them electroplated at his expense. In particular, he wanted a Herald picture of himself in a full beard. He wanted to have the autographs of my two names, Holmes and Mudgett, engraved and electroplated at the same time to go under the picture. He wanted this done quickly so that as soon as the manuscript was set in type, all components of the book would be in hand, ready for the presses." He offered King some marketing advice. "As soon as the book is published, get it onto the Philadelphia and New York newsstands. Then get reliable canvassers who will work afternoons here in Philadelphia. Take one good street at a time. Leave the book, then return about a half hour later for the money. No use to do this in the forenoon when people are busy. I canvassed when a student in this way and found the method successful. Then if you have any liking for the road, go over the ground covered by the book, spending a few days in Chicago, Detroit, and Indianapolis. Give copies to the newspapers in these cities to comment upon. It will assist the sale." Aware that this letter, too, would be read by the authorities, Holmes used it to reinforce obliquely his claims of innocence. He urged King that when his sales effort took him to Chicago, he should go to a particular hotel and look for evidence in the register and collect affidavits from clerks proving that Minnie Williams had stayed there with Holmes long after she was supposed to have been murdered. If she was a corpse then, Holmes wrote to King, she was a very lively corpse indeed. All the weary days. It was a strange moment for Geyer. He had examined every lead, checked every hotel, visited every boarding house and real estate agent, and yet now he had to begin his search anew. Where? What path was left? The weather remained stifling, as if taunting him. His instincts kept telling him that Holmes had killed Howard in Indianapolis. He returned there on July 24th and again received the assistance of Detective David Richards, but now Geyer also called in the press. The next day, every newspaper in the city reported his arrival. Dozens of people visited him at his hotel to make suggestions about where he ought to look for Howard. The number of mysterious persons who had rented houses in and about Indianapolis multiplied from day to day, Geyer wrote. He and Richards trudged through the heat from office to office, house to house, and found nothing. Days came and passed, but I continued to be as much in the dark as ever, and it began to look as though the bold but clever criminal had outwitted the detectives, and that the disappearance of Howard Pittitzel would pass into history as an unsolved mystery. Meanwhile, the mystery of Holmes himself grew deeper and darker. Geyer's discovery of the girls prompted Chicago police to enter Holmes's building in Englewood. Each day they delved more deeply into the secrets of the castle, and each day turned up additional evidence that Holmes was something far worse than even Geyer's macabre discoveries indicated. There was speculation that during the World's Fair he might have killed dozens of people, most of them young women. One estimate, certainly an exaggeration, put the toll at 200. To most people, it seemed impossible that Holmes could have done so much killing without detection. Geyer would have agreed, except that his own search had revealed again and again Holmes's talent for deflecting scrutiny. Chicago detectives began their exploration of the castle on the night of Friday, July 19th. First, they made a broad survey of the building. The third floor contained small hotel rooms. The second floor had 35 rooms that were harder to classify. Some were ordinary bedrooms, others had no windows and were fitted with doors that made the rooms airtight. One room contained a walk-in vault with iron walls. Police found a gas jet with no apparent function other than to admit gas into the vault. Its cutoff valve was located in Holmes's personal apartment. In Holmes's office, they found a bank book belonging to a woman named Lucy Burbank. It listed a balance of $23,000. The woman could not be located. The eeriest phase of the investigation began when the police, holding their flickering lanterns high, entered the hotel basement, a cavern of brick and timber measuring 50 by 165 feet. The discoveries came quickly. A vat of acid with 8 ribs and part of a skull settled at the bottom. Mounds of quicklime. A large kiln. A dissection table stained with what seemed to be blood. They found surgical tools and charred high-heeled shoes. And more bones. 18 ribs from the torso of a female child. Several vertebrae. A bone from a foot. 1 shoulder blade. 1 hip socket. Articles of clothing emerged from walls and from pits of ash and quicklime, including a girl's dress and blood-stained overalls. Human hair clotted a stovepipe. The searchers unearthed 2 buried vaults full of quicklime and human remains. They theorized the remains might be the last traces of two Texas women, Minnie and Anna Williams, whom Chicago police only recently learned were missing. In the ash of a large stove, they found a length of chain which the jeweler in Holmes's pharmacy recognized as part of a watch chain that Holmes had given Minnie Williams as a gift. They also found a letter Holmes had written to the pharmacist in his drugstore. "Do you ever see anything of the ghost of the Williams sisters?" Holmes wrote. "And do they trouble you much now?" The next day, the police discovered another hidden chamber, this one at the cellar's southwest corner. They were led to it by a man named Charles Chapel, alleged to have helped Holmes reduce corpses to bone. He was very cooperative, and soon the police recovered three fully articulated skeletons from their owners. A fourth was expected from Chicago's Hahnemann Medical College. One of the most striking discoveries came on the second floor in the walk-in vault. The inside of the door showed the unmistakable imprint of a woman's bare foot. Police theorized the print had been made by a woman suffocating within. Her name, they believed, was Emmeline Sigrund. Chicago police telegraphed District Attorney Graham that their search of the Holmes building had uncovered the skeleton of a child. Graham ordered Geyer to Chicago to see if the remains might be those of Howard Pitetzel. Geyer found the city transfixed by the revelations emerging from the castle. Press coverage had been exhaustive, taking up most of the front page of the daily newspapers. One Tribune headline had cried, "Victims of a Fiend," and reported erroneously that the remains of Howard Pitetzel had been found in the building. The story took up six of the seven columns of the front page. Geyer met with the lead police inspector and learned that a physician who had examined the child's skeleton had ruled it to be that of a little girl. The inspector thought he knew the girl's identity and mentioned a name, Pearl Connor. The name meant nothing to Geyer. Geyer telegraphed his disappointment to Graham, who ordered him back to Philadelphia for consultation and rest. On Wednesday evening, August 7th, with temperatures in the 90s and train cars like ovens, Geyer set out again, this time accompanied by Fidelity Mutual's top insurance investigator, Inspector W. E. Gary. Geyer was glad for the company. They went to Chicago, then to Indiana, where they stopped in Logansport and Peru, then to Montpelier Junction, Ohio, and Adrian, Michigan. They spent days searching the records of every hotel, boarding house, and real estate office they could find. All, Geyer said, to no purpose. Although Geyer's brief rest in Philadelphia had recharged his hopes, now he found them fast dwindling away. He still believed his original instinct was correct, that Howard was in Indianapolis or somewhere nearby. He went there next, his third visit of the summer. "I must confess I returned to Indianapolis in no cheerful frame of mind," Geyer wrote. He and Inspector Gary checked into Geyer's old hotel, the Spencer House. The failure to find Howard after so much effort was frustrating and puzzling. The mystery, Geyer wrote, seemed to be impenetrable. On Thursday, August 19th, Geyer learned that during the preceding night, Holmes's castle in Englewood, his own dark dreamland, had burned to the ground. Front page headlines in the Chicago Tribune shouted, "Holmes's den burned. Fire demolishes the place of murder and mystery." The fire department suspected arson. Police theorized that whoever set the fire had wanted to destroy the secrets still embedded within. They arrested no one. Together, Detective Geyer and Inspector Gary investigated 900 leads. They expanded their search to include small towns outside the city. "By Monday," Geyer wrote in a report to Superintendent Linden in Philadelphia, "we will have searched every outlying town except Irvington, and another day will conclude that." After Irvington, I scarcely know where we shall go. They went to Irvington on Tuesday morning, August 27, 1895, aboard an electric trolley, a new kind of streetcar that drew its power through a wheeled conducting apparatus on the roof called a trawler. Just before the trolley reached its final stop, Geyer spotted a sign for a real estate office. He and Gary resolved to begin their search there. The proprietor was a Mr. Brown. He offered the detectives each a chair, but they remained standing. They did not think the visit would last long, and there were many other offices to touch before nightfall. Geyer opened his now soiled parcel of photographs. Brown adjusted his glasses and examined the picture of Holmes. After a long pause, he said, "I did not have the renting of the house, but I had the keys. And one day last fall, this man came into my office and in a very abrupt way said, 'I want the keys for that house.'" Geyer and Gary stood very still. Brown continued, "I remember the man very well because I did not like his manner, and I felt that he should have had more respect for my gray hairs." The detectives looked at one another. Both sat down at the same time. "All the toil," Geyer said, "all the weary days and weeks of travel, toil and travel in the hottest months of the year, alternating between faith and hope and discouragement and despair, all were recompensed in that one moment when I saw the veil about to lift." At the inquest that followed, a young man named Elvet Moorman testified he had helped Holmes set up a large wood stove in the house. He recalled asking Holmes why he didn't install a gas stove instead. Holmes answered that he did not think gas was healthy for children. The owner of an Indianapolis repair shop testified that Holmes had come into his shop on October 3, 1894, with two cases of surgical instruments, and asked to have them sharpened. Holmes picked them up 3 days later. Detective Geyer testified as to how, during his search of the house, he opened the base of a chimney flue that extended from roof to cellar. While sifting the accumulated ash through a fly screen, he found human teeth and a fragment of jaw. He also retrieved a large, charred mass, which upon being cut disclosed a portion of the stomach, liver, and spleen, baked quite hard. The organs had been packed too tightly into the chimney, and thus never had burned. And, of course, Mrs. Pittitzel was summoned. She identified Howard's overcoat and his scarf pin, and a crochet needle that belonged to Alice. Finally, the coroner showed her a toy that Geyer himself had found in the house. It consisted of a tin man mounted on a spinning top. She recognized it. How could she not? It was Howard's most important possession. Mrs. Pittitzel herself had put it in the children's trunk just before she sent them off with Holmes. His father had bought it for him at the Chicago World's Fair. Malice aforethought. On September 12, 1995, a Philadelphia grand jury voted to indict Holmes for the murder of Benjamin Pittitzel. Only two witnesses presented evidence, L.G. Faust, president of Fidelity Mutual Life, and Detective Frank Geyer. Holmes stuck to his claim that Minnie Williams and the mysterious Hatch had killed the children. Grand juries in Indianapolis and Toronto found this unconvincing. Indianapolis indicted Holmes for the murder of Howard Pittitzel, Toronto for the murders of Alice and Nellie. If Philadelphia failed to convict him, there would be two more chances. If the city succeeded, the other indictments would be moot, for given the nature of the Pittitzel murder, a conviction in Philadelphia would bring a death sentence. Holmes's memoir reached newsstands. In its final pages, he stated, "In conclusion, I wish to say that I am but a very ordinary man, even below average in physical strength and mental ability, and to have planned and executed the stupendous amount of wrongdoing that has been attributed to me would have been wholly beyond my power. He asked the public to suspend judgment while he worked to disprove the charges against him, a task which I feel able to satisfactorily and expeditiously accomplish. And here, I cannot say, Finis, it is not the end. For besides doing this, there is also the work of bringing to justice those for whose wrongdoings I am today suffering, and this not to prolong or save my own life, for since the day I heard of the Toronto horror I have not cared to live, but that to those who have looked up to and honored me in the past, it shall not in the future be said that I suffered the ignominious death of a murderer. The thing editors could not understand was how Holmes had been able to escape serious investigation by the Chicago police. The Chicago Inter-Ocean said, "It is humiliating to think that had it not been for the exertions of the insurance companies which Holmes swindled, or attempted to swindle, he might yet be at large, preying upon society, so well did he cover up the traces of his crime." Chicago's feeling of humiliation was not surprising, the New York Times said. Anyone familiar with the saga must be amazed at the failure of the municipal police department and the local prosecuting officers not only to prevent those awful crimes, but even to procure any knowledge of them. One of the most surprising and perhaps dismaying revelations was that Chicago's chief of police, in his prior legal career, had represented Holmes in a dozen routine commercial lawsuits. The Chicago Times-Herald took the broad view and said of Holmes, "He is a prodigy of wickedness, a human demon, a being so unthinkable that no novelist would dare to invent such a character." The story, too, tends to illustrate the end of the century. Epilogue. The Last Crossing. The Fair. The fair had a powerful and lasting impact on the nation's psyche in ways both large and small. Walt Disney's father Elias helped build the White City. Walt's Magic Kingdom may well be a descendant. Certainly the fair made a powerful impression on the Disney family. It proved such a financial boon that when the family's third son was born that year, Elias, in gratitude, wanted to name him Columbus. His wife Flora intervened. The baby became Roy. Walt came next on December 5, 1901. The writer L. Frank Baum and his artist partner William Wallace Denslow visited the fair. Its grandeur informed their creation of Oz. The Japanese temple on the wooded island charmed Frank Lloyd Wright and influenced the evolution of his prairie residential designs. The fair prompted President Harrison to designate October 12th a national holiday, Columbus Day, which today serves to anchor a few thousand parades and a three-day weekend. Every carnival since 1893 has included a midway and a Ferris wheel, and every grocery store contains products born at the exposition. Shredded wheat did survive. Every house has scores of incandescent bulbs powered by alternating current, both of which first proved themselves worthy of large-scale use at the fair. And nearly every town of any size has its little bit of ancient Rome, some beloved and becolumned bank, library, or post office. Covered with graffiti, perhaps, or even an ill-conceived coat of paint, but underneath it all, the glow of the White City persists. Even the Lincoln Monument in Washington can trace its heritage to the fair. The fair's greatest impact lay in how it changed the way Americans perceived their cities and their architects. It primed the whole of America, not just a few rich architectural patrons, to think of cities in a way they never had before. Elihu Root said the fair led our people out of the wilderness of the commonplace to new ideas of architectural beauty and nobility. Henry Demarest Lloyd saw it as revealing to the great mass of Americans possibilities of social beauty, utility, and harmony of which they had not been able even to dream. No such vision could otherwise have entered into the prosaic drudgery of their lives, and it will be felt in their development into the third and fourth generation. The fair taught men and women, steeped only in the necessary, to see that cities did not have to be dark, soiled, and unsafe bastions of the strictly pragmatic. They could also be beautiful. William Stead recognized the power of the fair immediately. The vision of the white city and its profound contrast to the black city drove him to write If Christ Came to Chicago, a book often credited with launching the City Beautiful movement, which sought to elevate American cities to the level of the great cities of Europe. Like Stead, civic authorities throughout the world saw the fair as a model of what to strive for. They asked Burnham to apply the same citywide thinking that had gone into the white city to their own cities. He became a pioneer in modern urban planning. He created citywide plans for Cleveland, San Francisco, and Manila, and led the turn-of-the-century effort to resuscitate and expand L'Enfant's vision of Washington, D.C. In each case, he worked without a fee. While helping design the new Washington plan, Burnham persuaded the head of the Pennsylvania Railroad, Alexander Cassatt, to remove his freight tracks and depot from the center of the Federal Mall, thus creating the unobstructed green that extends today from the Capitol to the Lincoln Memorial. Other cities came to Daniel Burnham for citywide plans, among them Fort Worth, Atlantic City, and St. Louis, but he turned them down to concentrate on his last plan for the city of Chicago. Over the years, many aspects of his Chicago plan were adopted, among them the creation of the city's lovely ribbon of lakefront parks and Michigan Avenue's Miracle Mile. One portion of the lakefront, named Burnham Park in his honor, contains Soldier Field and the Field Museum, which he designed. The park runs south in a narrow green border along the lakeshore all the way to Jackson Park, where the fair's Palace of Fine Arts, transformed into a permanent structure, now houses the Museum of Science and Industry. It looks out over the lagoons and the wooded island, now a wild and tangled place that perhaps would make Olmsted smile, though no doubt he would find features to criticize. Early in the 20th century, the fair became a source of heated debate among architects. Critics claimed the fair extinguished the Chicago School of Architecture, an indigenous vernacular, and replaced it with a renewed devotion to obsolete classical styles. Parroted from thesis to thesis, this view first gained prominence through a curiously personal dynamic that made it difficult and, as is often the case in the cramped and stuffy rooms of academic debate, even dangerous to resist. It was Lewis Sullivan who first and most loudly condemned the fair's influence on architecture, but only late in his life and long after Burnham's death. Things had not gone well for Sullivan after the fair. During the first year of the post-fair depression, the firm of Adler and Sullivan received only two commissions. In 1895, none. In July 1895, Adler quit the firm. Sullivan was 38 and incapable of cultivating the relationships that might have generated enough new commissions to keep him solvent. He was a loner and intellectually intolerant. When a fellow architect asked Sullivan for suggestions on how to improve one of his designs, Sullivan replied, "If I told you, you wouldn't know what I was talking about." As his practice faltered, Sullivan found himself forced to leave his office in the auditorium and to sell his personal belongings. He drank heavily and took mood-altering drugs called bromides. Between 1895 and 1922, Sullivan built only 25 new structures, roughly one a year. From time to time, he came to Burnham for money, although whether he sought outright loans or sold Burnham artwork from his personal collection is unclear. An entry in Burnham's diary for 1911 states, "Lewis Sullivan called to get more money of D.H.B." That same year, Sullivan inscribed a set of drawings to Daniel H. Burnham with the best wishes of his friend, Lewis H. Sullivan. But Sullivan laced his 1924 autobiography with hyperbolic attacks on Burnham and the fair's impact on the masses who came through its gates. The classical architecture of the White City made such a profound impression, Sullivan claimed, that it doomed America to another half-century of imitation. The fair was a contagion, a virus, a form of progressive cerebral meningitis. In his view, it had fatal consequences. Thus, architecture died in the land of the free and the home of the brave, in a land declaring its fervid democracy, its inventiveness, its resourcefulness, its unique daring, enterprise, and progress. Sullivan's low opinion of Burnham and the fair was counterbalanced only by his own exalted view of himself and what he saw as his role in attempting to bring to architecture something fresh and distinctly American. Frank Lloyd Wright took up Sullivan's banner. Sullivan had fired him in 1893, but later Wright and Sullivan became friends. As Wright's academic star rose, so too did Sullivan's. Burnham's fell from the sky. It became de rigueur among architectural critics and historians to argue that Burnham, in his insecurity and slavish devotion to the classical yearnings of the Eastern architects, had indeed killed American architecture. But that view was too simplistic, as architectural historians and critics have more recently acknowledged. The fair awakened America to beauty, and as such was a necessary passage that laid the foundation for men like Frank Lloyd Wright and Mies van der Rohe. For Burnham personally, the fair had been an unqualified triumph. It allowed him to fulfill his pledge to his parents to become the greatest architect in America, for certainly in his day he had become so. During the fair, an event occurred whose significance to Burnham was missed by all but his closest friends. Both Harvard and Yale granted him honorary master's degrees in recognition of his achievement in building the fair. The ceremonies occurred on the same day. He attended Harvard's. For him, the awards were a form of redemption. His past failure to gain admission to both universities, the denial of his right beginning, had haunted him throughout his life. Even years after the awards, as he lobbied Harvard to grant provisional admission to his son Daniel, whose own performance on the entry exams was far from stellar, Burnham wrote, "He needs to know that he is a winner, and, as soon as he does, he will show his real quality, as I have been able to do. It is the keenest regret of my life that someone did not follow me up at Cambridge and let the authorities know what I could do." Burnham had shown them himself in Chicago through the hardest sort of work. He bristled at the persistent belief that John Root deserved most of the credit for the beauty of the fair. "What was done up to the time of his death was the faintest suggestion of a plan," he said. "The impression concerning his part has been gradually built up by a few people, close friends of his and mostly women, who naturally, after the fair proved beautiful, desired to more broadly identify his memory with it." Root's death had crushed Burnham, but it also freed him to become a broader, better architect. "It was questioned by many if the loss of Mr. Root was not irreparable," wrote James Ellsworth in a letter to Burnham's biographer Charles Moore. Ellsworth concluded that Root's death brought out qualities in Mr. Burnham which might not have developed, as early, anyway, had Mr. Root lived. The common perception had always been that Burnham managed the business side of the firm, while Root did all the designs. Burnham did seem to lean more or less on Root's artistic abilities, Ellsworth said, but added that after Root's death, one would never realize anything of this kind, or ever know from his actions that he ever possessed a partner or did not always command in both directions. In 1901, Burnham built the Fuller Building at the triangular intersection of 23rd and Broadway in New York, but neighborhood residents found an uncanny resemblance to a common domestic tool and called it the Flatiron Building. Burnham and his firm went on to build scores of other structures, among them the Gimbel's Department Store in New York, Filene in Boston, and the Mount Wilson Observatory in Pasadena, California. Of the 27 buildings he and John Root built in Chicago's Loop, only three remain today, among them the Rookery, its top-floor library much as it was during that magical meeting in February 1891, and the Reliance Building, beautifully transformed into the Hotel Burnham. Its restaurant is called the Atwood, after Charles Atwood, who replaced Root as Burnham's chief designer. Burnham became an early environmentalist. "Up to our time," he said, "strict economy in the use of natural resources has not been practiced, but it must be henceforth unless we are immoral enough to impair conditions in which our children are to live." He had great, if misplaced, faith in the automobile. "The passing of the horse would end a plague of barbarism," he said. "When this change comes, a real step in civilization will have been taken. With no smoke, no gases, no litter of horses, your air and streets will be clean and pure. This means, does it not, that the health and spirits of men will be better?" On winter nights in Evanston, he and his wife went sleigh riding with Mr. and Mrs. Frank Lloyd Wright. Burnham became an avid player of bridge, though he was known widely for being utterly inept at the game. It is possible he had a lover. One letter from an address on Pine Street in San Francisco: "I pen this to tell you that I think of you with real love, lots of times in the daytime, and when I lie awake at night." He had promised his wife that after the exposition the pace of his work would ease. But this did not happen. He told Margaret, "I thought the fair was an intense life, but I find the pressing forward of all these important interests gives me quite as full a day, week, or year." Burnham's health began to decline early in the 20th century, when he was in his 50s. He developed colitis and in 1909 learned he had diabetes. Both conditions forced him to adopt a more healthful diet. His diabetes damaged his circulatory system and caused a foot infection that bedeviled him for the rest of his life. As the years passed, he revealed an interest in the supernatural. One night in San Francisco, in a bungalow he had built at the fog-licked summit of Twin Peaks, his planning shanty, he told a friend, "If I were able to take the time, I believe that I could prove the continuation of life beyond the grave, reasoning from the necessity, philosophically speaking, of a belief in an absolute and universal power." He knew that his day was coming to an end. On July 4, 1909, as he stood with friends on the roof of the Reliance Building, looking out over the city he adored, he said, "You'll see it lovely." "I never will, but it will be lovely." Recessional. The roaring in Olmsted's ears, the pain in his mouth, and the sleeplessness never eased, and soon an emptiness began to appear in his gaze. He became forgetful. On May 10, 1895, 2 weeks after his 73rd birthday, he wrote to his son John, "It has today for the first time become evident to me that my memory for recent occurrences is no longer to be trusted." He was 73 years old. That summer, on his last day in the Brookline office, he wrote three letters to George Vanderbilt, each saying pretty much the same thing. During a period in September 1895 that he described as the bitterest week of my life, he confessed to his friend Charles Eliot his terror that his condition soon would require that he be placed in an asylum. "You cannot think how I have been dreading that it would be thought expedient that I should be sent to an institution," he wrote on September 26th. "Anything but that. My father was a director of an insane retreat, and first and last, having been professionally employed and behind the scenes in several, my dread of such places is intense." His loss of memory accelerated. He became depressed and paranoid and accused son John of orchestrating a coup to remove him from the firm. Olmsted's wife Mary took Olmsted to the family's island home in Maine, where his depression deepened and he at times became violent. He beat the family horse. Mary and her sons realized there was little they could do for Olmsted. He had become unmanageable, his dementia profound. With deep sorrow and perhaps a good deal of relief, Rick lodged his father in the McLean Asylum in Waverly, Massachusetts. Olmsted's memory was not so destroyed that he did not realize he himself had designed McLean's grounds. This gave him no solace, for he saw immediately that the same phenomenon that had diminished nearly every one of his works, Central Park, Biltmore, the World's Fair, and so many others, had occurred yet again. "They didn't carry out my plan," he wrote. "Confound them!" Olmsted died at 2 in the morning on August 28, 1903. His funeral was spare, family only. His wife, who had seen this great man disappear before her eyes, did not attend. The Ferris wheel cleared $200,000 at the fair and remained in place until the spring of 1894, when George Ferris dismantled it and reassembled it on Chicago's north side. By then, however, it had lost both its novelty and the volume of ridership that the Midway had guaranteed. The wheel began losing money. These losses, added to the $150,000 cost of moving it and the financial damage done to Ferris's steel inspection company by the continuing depression, caused Ferris to sell most of his ownership of the wheel. In the autumn of 1896, Ferris and his wife separated. She went home to her parents. He moved into the Duquesne Hotel in downtown Pittsburgh. On November 17, 1896, he was taken to Mercy Hospital, where he died 5 days later, apparently of typhoid fever. He was 37 years old. 1 year later, his ashes were still in the possession of the undertaker who had received his body. The request of Mrs. Ferris for the ashes was refused, the undertaker said, because the dead man left closer relatives. In a eulogy, two friends said Ferris had miscalculated his powers of endurance, and he died a martyr to his ambition for fame and prominence. In 1903, the Chicago House Wrecking Company bought the wheel at auction for $8,150, then reassembled it at the Louisiana Purchase Exposition of 1904. There, the wheel again became profitable and earned its new owners $215,000. On May 11, 1906, the wrecking company dynamited the wheel for scrap. The first 100-pound charge was supposed to cut the wheel loose from its supports and topple it onto its side. Instead, the wheel began a slow turn, as if seeking one last roll through the sky. It crumpled under its own weight into a mountain of bent steel. Saul Bloom, chief of the Midway, emerged from the fair a rich young man. He invested heavily in a company that bought perishable foods and shipped them in the latest refrigerated cars to far-off cities. It was a fine, forward-looking business. But the Pullman strike halted all train traffic through Chicago, and the perishable foods rotted in their train cars. He was ruined. He was still young, however, and still Bloom. He used his remaining funds to buy two expensive suits, on the theory that whatever he did next, he had to look convincing. "But one thing was quite clear," he wrote. "Being broke didn't disturb me in the least. I had started with nothing, and if I now found myself with nothing, I was at least even. Actually, I was much better than even. I had had a wonderful time." Bloom went on to become a congressman and one of the crafters of the charter that founded the United Nations. The fair made Buffalo Bill $1 million, about $30 million today, which he used to found the town of Cody, Wyoming, build a cemetery and fairground for North Platte, Nebraska, pay the debts of 5 North Platte churches, acquire a Wisconsin newspaper, and further the theatrical fortunes of a lovely young actress named Catherine Clemens, thereby deepening the already pronounced alienation of his wife. At one point, he accused his wife of trying to poison him. The panic of 1907 destroyed his Wild West and forced him to hire himself out to circuses. He was over 70 years old, but still rode the ring under his big white hat trimmed in silver. He died in Denver at his sister's house on January 10, 1917, without even the money to pay for his burial. Theodore Dreiser married Sarah Osborne White. In 1898, 2 years before publishing Sister Carrie, he wrote to Sarah, "I went to Jackson Park and saw what is left of the dear old World's Fair where I learned to love you." He cheated on her repeatedly. For Dora Root, life with John had been like living upon a comet. Their marriage had brought her into a world of art and money where everything seemed energized and alive. Her husband's wit, his musical talent, those exquisite long fingers so evident in any photograph, imparted a gleam to her days that she was never able to recapture after his death. Toward the end of the first decade of the 20th century, she wrote a long letter to Burnham. "It means so much to me that you think I have done well all these years," she wrote. "I have such grave doubts about myself whenever I stop to think about the subject, that a word of encouragement from one who has so wonderfully sounded out his life gives me a new impetus. If absorbing myself before the coming generation and humbly passing on the torch is the whole duty of women, I believe I have earned a word of praise." But she knew that with John's death, the doors to a brighter kingdom had softly but firmly closed. "If John had lived," she told Burnham, "all would have been different. Under the stimulus of his exhilarating life, I would have been his wife as well as the mother of his children. And it would have been interesting." Patrick Eugene Joseph Prendergast stood trial in December 1893. The prosecutor was a criminal attorney hired by the state just for this case. His name was Alfred S. Trude. Prendergast's lawyers tried to prove Prendergast was insane, but a jury of angry, grieving Chicagoans believed otherwise. One important piece of evidence tending to support the prosecution's case for sanity was the care Prendergast had taken to keep an empty chamber under the hammer of his revolver as he carried it in his pocket. At 2:28 p.m. on December 29th, after conferring for an hour and 3 minutes, the jury found him guilty. The judge sentenced him to death. Throughout his trial and subsequent appeal, he continued to send Trude postcards. He wrote on February 21, 1894, "No one should be put to death, no matter who it is, if it can be avoided. It is demoralizing to society to be barbarous." Clarence Darrow entered the case and, in a novel maneuver, won for Prendergast a sanity inquest. This too failed, however, and Prendergast was executed. Darrow called him a poor, demented imbecile. The execution intensified Darrow's already deep hatred of the death penalty. "I am sorry for all fathers and all mothers," he said years later, during his defense of Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb, accused of killing a Chicago boy for the thrill of it. "The mother who looks into the blue eyes of her little babe cannot help musing over the end of the child, whether it will be crowned with the greatest promises which her mind can image, or whether he may meet death upon the scaffold." Leopold and Loeb, as they became known worldwide, had stripped their victim to mask his identity. They dumped some of his clothes in Olmsted's lagoons at Jackson Park. In New York, at the Waldorf Astoria, a few years into the new century, several dozen young men in evening clothes gathered around a gigantic pie. The whipped cream topping began to move. A woman emerged. She was stunning, with olive skin and long black hair. Her name was Ferida Majar. The men were too young to remember, but once, a long while before, she had done the Danse du Ventre at the greatest fair in history. What the men noticed now was that she wore nothing at all. Holmes. In the fall of 1895, Holmes stood trial in Philadelphia for the murder of Benjamin F. Pititzel. District Attorney George Graham brought 35 witnesses to Philadelphia from Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Irvington, Detroit, Toronto, Boston, Burlington, and Fort Worth, but they never were called. The judge ruled Graham could present only evidence tied directly to the Pititzel murder, and thus eliminated from the historical record a rich seam of detail on the murders of Dr. Herman W. Mudgett, alias Holmes. Graham also brought to the courtroom the wart Holmes had removed from Benjamin Pititzel's corpse and a wooden box containing Pititzel's skull. There was a good deal of macabre testimony about decomposition and body fluids and the effects of chloroform. There was a red fluid issuing from his mouth, testified Dr. William Scott, a pharmacist who had accompanied police to the house where Pititzel's body had been discovered, and any little pressure on the stomach or over the chest here would cause this fluid to flow more rapidly. After one particularly grisly stretch of Dr. Scott's testimony, Holmes stood and said, "I would ask that the court be adjourned for sufficient time for lunch." There were sorrowful moments, especially when Mrs. Pititzel took the stand. She wore a black dress, black hat, and black cape, and looked pale and sad. Often she paused in mid-sentence and rested her head on her hands. Graham showed her the letters from Alice and Nellie and asked her to identify the handwriting. These were a surprise to her. She broke down. Holmes showed no emotion. It was an expression of utmost indifference, a reporter for the Philadelphia Public Ledger said. He made his notes with a manner as unconcerned as if he were sitting in his own office writing a business letter. Graham asked Mrs. Pititzel whether she had seen the children since the time in 1894 when Holmes took them away. She answered in a voice almost too soft to hear, "I saw them at Toronto in the morgue, side by side." So many handkerchiefs appeared among the men and women in the gallery that the courtroom looked as if it had just experienced a sudden snowfall. Graham called Holmes the most dangerous man in the world. The jury found him guilty. The judge sentenced him to death by hanging. Holmes's attorneys appealed the conviction and lost. As Holmes awaited execution, he prepared a long confession, his third, in which he admitted killing 27 people. As with two previous confessions, this one was a mixture of truth and falsehood. A few of the people he claimed to have murdered turned out to be alive. Exactly how many people he killed won't ever be known. At the very least, he killed 9. Julia and Pearl Connor, Emmeline Sigrund, the Williams sisters, and Pititzel and his children. No one doubted that he had killed many others. Estimates ranged as high as 200, though such extravagance seems implausible, even for a man of his appetite. Detective Geyer believed that if the Pinkertons had not caught up with Holmes and arranged his arrest in Boston, he would have killed the rest of the Pititzel family. That he fully intended to murder Mrs. Pititzel and Desi and the baby Wharton is too evident for contradiction. Holmes, in his confession, also clearly lied, or at least was deeply deluded, when he wrote, "I am convinced that since my imprisonment I have changed woefully and gruesomely from what I was formerly in feature and figure. My head and face are gradually assuming an elongated shape. I believe fully that I am growing to resemble the devil, that the similitude is almost completed." His description of killing Alice and Nellie rang true, however. He said he placed the girls in a large trunk and made an opening in its top. "Here I left them until I could return and, at my leisure, kill them. At 5 p.m. I borrowed a spade of a neighbor and at the same time called on Mrs. Pititzel at her hotel. I then returned to my hotel and ate my dinner, and at 7 o'clock p.m. I again returned to the house where the children were imprisoned, and ended their lives by connecting the gas with the trunk. Then came the opening of the trunk and the viewing of their little blackened and distorted faces, then the digging of their shallow graves in the basement of the house. He said of Pititzel, "It will be understood that from the first hour of our acquaintance, even before I knew he had a family who would later afford me additional victims for the gratification of my bloodthirstiness, I intended to kill him. Afraid that someone would steal his own body after his execution, Holmes left instructions with his lawyers for how he was to be buried. He refused to allow an autopsy. His lawyers turned down an offer of $5,000 for his body. The Wistar Institute in Philadelphia wanted his brain. This request, too, the lawyers refused, much to the regret of Milton Greeman, curator of Wistar's renowned collection of medical anomalies. The man was something more than a mere criminal who acted on impulse, Greeman said. He was a man who studied crime and planned his career. His brain might have given science valuable aid." Shortly before 10 a.m. on May 7, 1896, after a breakfast of boiled eggs, dry toast, and coffee, Holmes was escorted to the gallows at Moyamensing Prison. This was a difficult moment for his guards. They liked Holmes. They knew he was a killer, but he was a charming killer. The assistant superintendent, a man named Richardson, seemed nervous as he readied the noose. Holmes turned to him and smiled and said, "Take your time, old man." At 10:13, Richardson released the trap and hanged him. Using Holmes's instructions, workmen in the employ of Undertaker John J. O'Rourke filled a coffin with cement, then placed Holmes's body inside and covered it with more cement. They hauled him south through the countryside to Holy Cross Cemetery, a Catholic burial ground in Delaware County, just south of Philadelphia. With great effort, they transferred the heavy coffin to the cemetery's central vault, where two Pinkerton detectives guarded the body overnight. They took turns sleeping in a white pine coffin. The next day, workers opened a double grave and filled this, too, with cement, then inserted the coffin. They placed more cement on top and closed the grave. Holmes's idea was evidently to guard his remains in every way from scientific enterprise, from the pickling vat and the knife, the Public Ledger reported. Strange things began to happen that made Holmes's claims about being the devil seem almost plausible. Detective Geyer became seriously ill. The warden of Moyamensing Prison committed suicide. The jury foreman was electrocuted in a freak accident. The priest who delivered Holmes's last rites was found dead on the grounds of his church of mysterious causes. The father of Emmeline Sigrund was grotesquely burned in a boiler explosion. And a fire destroyed the office of District Attorney George Graham, leaving only a photograph of Holmes unscathed. No stone or tomb marks the grave of Herman Webster Mudgett, alias H.H. Holmes. His presence in Holy Cross Cemetery is something of a secret, recorded only in an ancient registry volume that lists his location as Section 15, Range 10, Lot 41, at the center of graves 3 and 4, just off a lane that the cemetery calls Lazarus Avenue, after the biblical character who died and was restored to life. The entry also notes 10 feet of cement. At the gravesite, there is only an open lawn in the midst of other old graves. There are children and a World War I pilot. No one ever left flowers here for Holmes, but as it happens, he was not entirely forgotten. In 1997, police in Chicago arrested a physician named Michael Swango at O'Hare Airport. The initial charge was fraud, but Swango was suspected of being a serial killer who murdered hospital patients through the administration of lethal doses of drugs. Eventually, Dr. Swango pled guilty to 4 murders, but investigators believed he committed many more. During the airport arrest, police found in Swango's possession a notebook in which he had copied passages from certain books, either for the inspiration they provided or because of some affirming resonance. One passage was from a book about H.H. Holmes called The Torture Doctor by David Frank. The copied passage sought to put the reader into Holmes's mind. He could look at himself in a mirror and tell himself that he was one of the most powerful and dangerous men in the world, Swango's notebook read. He could feel that he was a god in disguise. Aboard the Olympic. Aboard the Olympic, Burnham waited for more news of Frank Millet and his ship. Just before sailing, he had written in longhand a 19-page letter to Millet, urging him to attend the next meeting of the Lincoln Commission, which was then on the verge of deciding who would be awarded the commission to design the Lincoln Memorial. Burnham and Millet had lobbied strongly for Henry Bacon of New York, and Burnham believed that his earlier talk to the Lincoln Commission had been persuasive. But I know, and you know, dear Frank, that the rats swarm back and begin to gnaw at the same old spot the moment the dog's back is turned. He stressed how important it was for Millet to attend. Be there and reiterate the real argument, which is that they should select a man in whom we have confidence. I leave this thing confidently in your hands. He addressed the envelope himself, certain that the United States Post Office would know exactly what to do. Honorable F. D. Millet, to arrive on steamship Titanic, New York. Burnham hoped that once the Olympic reached the site of Titanic's sinking, he would find Millet alive and hear him tell some outrageous story about the voyage. But during the night, the Olympic returned to its original course for England. Another vessel already had reached Titanic. But there was a second reason for the Olympic's return to course. The builder of both ships, J. Bruce Ismay, himself a Titanic passenger but one of the few male passengers to survive, was adamant that none of the other survivors see this duplicate of their own lost liner coming to their aid. The shock, he feared, would be too great and too humiliating to the White Star Line. The magnitude of the Titanic disaster quickly became apparent. Burnham lost his friend. The steward lost his son. William Stead also had been aboard and was drowned. In 1886, in the Pall Mall Gazette, Stead had warned of the disasters likely to occur if shipping companies continued operating liners with too few lifeboats. A Titanic survivor reported hearing him say, "I think it is nothing serious, so I shall turn in again." That night, in the silence of Burnham's stateroom, as somewhere to the north the body of his last good friend drifted frozen in the strangely peaceful seas of the North Atlantic, Burnham opened his diary and began to write. He felt an acute loneliness. He wrote, "Frank Millet, whom I loved, was aboard her, thus cutting off my connection with one of the best fellows of the fair." Burnham lived only 47 more days. As he and his family traveled through Heidelberg, he slipped into a coma, the result apparently of a combined assault of diabetes, colitis, and his foot infection, all worsened by a bout of food poisoning. He died June 1, 1912. Margaret eventually moved to Pasadena, California, where she lived through time of war and epidemic and crushing financial depression, and then war again. She died December 23, 1945. Both are buried in Graceland Cemetery, on a tiny island in the cemetery's only pond. John Root lies nearby, as do the Palmers, Lewis Sullivan, Mayor Harrison, Marshall Field, Philip Armour, and so many others, in vaults and tombs that vary from the simple to the grand. Potter and Bertha still dominate things, as if stature mattered even in death. They occupy a massive acropolis with 15 giant columns atop the only high ground overlooking the pond. The others cluster around. On a crystalline fall day, you can almost hear the tinkle of fine crystal, the rustle of silk and wool, almost smell the expensive cigars. Notes and sources. The thing that entranced me about Chicago in the Gilded Age was the city's willingness to take on the impossible in the name of civic honor, a concept so removed from the modern psyche that two wise readers of early drafts of this book wondered why Chicago was so avid to win the World's Fair in the first place. The juxtaposition of pride and unfathomed evil struck me as offering powerful insights into the nature of men and their ambitions. The more I read about the fair, the more entranced I became. That George Ferris would attempt to build something so big and novel, and that he would succeed on his first try, seems in this day of liability lawsuits almost beyond comprehension. A rich seam of information exists about the fair and about Daniel Burnham in the beautifully run archives of the Chicago Historical Society and the Ryerson and Burnham libraries of the Art Institute of Chicago. I acquired a nice base of information from the University of Chicago's Suzzallo Library, one of the finest and most efficient libraries I have encountered. I also visited the Library of Congress in Washington, where I spent a good many happy hours immersed in the papers of Frederick Law Olmsted, though my happiness was at times strained by trying to decipher Olmsted's execrable handwriting. I read and mined dozens of books about Burnham, Chicago, the Exposition, and the late Victorian era. Several proved consistently valuable. Thomas Hines's Burnham of Chicago, 1974. Laura Wood Roper's FLO, a biography of Frederick Law Olmsted, 1973. And Witold Rybczynski's A Clearing in the Distance, 1999. One book in particular, City of the Century by Donald L. Miller, 1996, became an invaluable companion in my journey through old Chicago. I found four guidebooks to be especially useful. Alice Sinkovich's AIA Guide to Chicago, Matt Huck and Ursula Bielski's Graveyards of Chicago, 1999, John Flynn's Official Guide to the World's Columbian Exposition, 1893, and Rand McNally and Company's Handbook to the World's Columbian Exposition, 1893. Huck and Bielski's guide led me to pay a visit to Graceland Cemetery, an utterly charming haven where, paradoxically, history comes alive. Holmes proved an elusive character, owing in large part to the Philadelphia judge's unfortunate decision to bar District Attorney Graham's 36 witnesses from giving testimony. Several books have been written about Holmes, but none tells quite the same story. Two of them, Harold Schechter's Depraved and David Frank's The Torture Doctor, the work quoted by the modern serial killer Dr. Swango, seem the most trustworthy. Two other works exist that provide a concrete foundation of facts. One is Detective Frank Geyer's memoir, The Holmes-Pititzel Case, a detailed account of events from the time of Holmes's arrest onward, in which Geyer presents excerpts of primary documents that no longer exist. I was lucky enough to acquire a copy from an online seller of antique books. The second is The Trial of Herman W. Mudgett, alias H.H. Holmes, published in 1897, a complete transcript of the trial. I found a copy in the law library of the University of Washington. Holmes left a memoir, Holmes's Own Story, which I found in the Library of Congress's rare book collection. He also made at least three confessions. The first two appear in Geyer's book. The third and most sensational appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer, which paid him a rich fee to write it. Though mostly untrue, his memoir and confessions were nuggeted with details that jibed with facts established in court or unearthed by Geyer and by the legions of reporters who covered Holmes' story after his arrest in Boston. I relied heavily on newspaper articles published in the Chicago Tribune and in two Philadelphia newspapers, The Inquirer and The Public Ledger. Many of these articles also were full of inaccuracies and, I suspect, embellishments. I mined them for bits of apparent fact and for reproductions of original documents, such as letters, telegrams, interviews, and other primary materials uncovered by police or produced by witnesses who stepped forward once the nature of Holmes's Castle of Horrors became front-page news. One of the most striking and rather charming aspects of criminal investigation in the 1890s is the extent to which the police gave reporters direct access to crime scenes, even while investigations were in progress. At one point during the Holmes investigation, Chicago's chief of police told a Tribune reporter he'd just as soon have a squad of reporters under his command as detectives. Exactly what motivated Holmes may never be known. In focusing on his quest for possession and dominance, I present only one possibility, though I recognize that any number of other motives might well be posited. I base my account on known details of his history and behavior, and on what forensic psychiatrists have come to understand about psychopathic serial killers and the forces that drive them. Dr. James O. Rainey, a Seattle psychiatrist who now and then provides forensic evaluations, read the manuscript and gave me his observations about the nature of psychopaths, known more tediously in today's psychiatric handbooks as people afflicted with antisocial personality disorder. It is a good thing Alfred Hitchcock died before the change was made. Clearly no one other than Holmes was present during his murders. No one, that is, who survived. Yet in my book I recreate two of his killings. I agonized over exactly how to do this and spent a good deal of time rereading Truman Capote's In Cold Blood for insights into how Capote achieved his dark and still deeply troubling account. Sadly, Capote left no footnotes. To build my murder scenes, I used threads of known detail and used these to weave a plausible account, as would a prosecutor in his closing arguments to a jury. My description of Julia Connor's death by chloroform is based on expert testimony presented at Holmes's trial about the character of chloroform and what was known at the time about its effect on the human body. I do not employ researchers, nor did I conduct any primary research using the Internet. I need physical contact with my sources, and there's only one way to get it. To me, every trip to a library or archive is like a small detective story. There are always little moments on such trips when the past flares to life, like a match in the darkness. On one visit to the Chicago Historical Society, I found the actual notes that Prendergast sent to Alfred Trude. I saw how deeply the pencil dug into the paper. I have tried to keep my citations as concise as possible. I cite all quoted or controversial material, but omit citations for facts that are widely known and accepted. For the two murder scenes, I document my reasoning and my approach, and cite the facts upon which I relied. The citations that follow constitute a map. Anyone retracing my steps ought to reach the same conclusions as I. This concludes the reading of Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. Copyright 2003 by Eric Larson. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, and was produced in 2003 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book was read by Scott Brick.